Good morning, all. Energy and Climate Finance and Policy will come to order. We are so pleased to be welcoming the Commissioner of Commerce, Steve Kelly, and to be speaking on Representative Long's bill. Representative Long, would you like to move your bill?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move my bill, please.
Representative Long moves that 1956 be laid over for possible inclusion. Yes. We do have a quorum, members, just noting that for the record. Representative Long.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I want to start by commending Governor Walz for his bold clean energy leadership with proposing this bill. The governor recognizes the serious challenge that climate change poses to Minnesota. We have failed to meet the greenhouse gas targets we've set as a state and are not currently on track to meet our future targets. As testifiers have told members of this committee, Minnesota is the most impacted state in the nation in terms of the rate of climate change. And if you look at large cities, Minneapolis, the city I represent, is the most impacted city in the nation. Governor Walz recognizes this challenge and recognizes that we need to respond and respond in a concerted way. Governor Walz also recognizes that we can grow Minnesota's economy with clean energy jobs. Our business community recognizes this as well and is leading the way. Just 2 weeks ago, our state's largest industrial company, 3M, committed itself to 100% clean energy. And just yesterday, Clean Energy Economy Minnesota released a Bloomberg report that found that clean energy is very affordable for Minnesotans. It found the cost of wind declined 16% last year, and the cost of solar declined 23% last year. In fact, the 2018 estimates for Minnesota that Bloomberg compiled for the levelized cost of energy put wind at $38 per megawatt hour unsubsidized and $26 per megawatt hour subsidized, compared to a mid-case estimate for combined cycle natural gas of $52.05 per megawatt hour. It's no surprise then that wind produced 18% of Minnesota's power last year. Solar in Minnesota, under the Bloomberg estimate, was $39 per megawatt hour after accounting for subsidies, making it currently competitive with natural gas, and we know that the cost of solar is only going to come down. The report also heralded Minnesota's energy efficiency efforts, ranking us as eighth in the nation. The bill that we're hearing today helps Minnesota achieve affordable, reliable, and clean energy in three ways. First, it sets a standard of 100% clean energy by 2050. We know that this is not only achievable, it's necessary if we are to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Second, the bill beefs up our existing renewable energy preference, also includes storage, energy efficiency, and demand-side management. I'd like to especially thank Representative Zach Stevenson for his leadership on the Clean Energy First proposal in the House and for his good work on bringing this forward. The bill also includes important support for workers as we make this transition, including assuring large projects are creating good-paying jobs for Minnesota workers. Third, the bill strengthens our conservation improvement program to further our state's impressive gains in energy efficiency. The Star Tribune editorial board put it nicely about the opportunity our state is facing, and I quote, "Minnesota is well positioned for a transition. The land here carries no natural reserves of coal, natural gas, or petroleum. Every bit of fossil fuel the state uses must be imported from elsewhere. What is its natural energy resource? Endless renewable wind rolling across its broad expanses of prairie." With that, I would like to invite Commissioner Kelly to walk through the bill in more detail.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here. I am excited. I'm Steve Kelly, and I am the Commissioner of the Commerce Department, and I'm excited to be here to present the proposal from Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for One Minnesota's Path to Clean Energy, which leads Minnesota to 100% clean energy in the state's electricity sector by 2050. First, I want to thank Representative Long for his leadership on this issue and his support and authorship of this proposal. And as he said, Representative Stevenson and others have worked on components of this package, and the governor is pleased to have the opportunity to build on their work in putting this package together. This proposal is a set of three policies that work together to decarbonize the electric power sector and optimize energy use by Minnesota utilities, consumers, and businesses. A clean energy standard for Minnesota's utilities to generate 100% of their electricity from carbon-free sources by 2050. Clean Energy First, which ensures retiring power plants are replaced with wind, solar, energy efficiency, and new innovative clean energy resources before natural gas or other emitting resources can be considered, and the Energy Optimization Act, helping Minnesota homes and businesses become more efficient through modernization of the Conservation Improvement Program. The One Minnesota Path to Clean Energy ensures affordability. We know that after years of declining prices, clean energy is now the most affordable resource, and that means savings for consumers. Establishing a clean energy standard of 100% by 2050 is ambitious, but it builds on the success we've already achieved and extends the clean energy trajectory we were already on so that we can boost local jobs and improve the resilience of communities across the state. The 100% standard sets a destination that does not dictate a specific roadmap for getting there. It allows flexibility for utilities to choose their own best course. This policy prioritizes local jobs, enabling Minnesota workers to be an essential part of the solution. Already, more than 59,000 Minnesotans work in clean energy, with 40% of those jobs in greater Minnesota. Manufacturers from Rochester to Alexandria are adding workers, and main streets are revitalized as buildings are updated and made more efficient. As we build the homegrown clean energy economy, we can expect this number to go higher. The Clean Energy First policy will broaden Minnesota's existing preference for clean energy in utility resource planning. Minnesota's current electric generation system is aging and at a critical juncture. And in the next two decades, over 70% of the electricity in the state will be up for retirement or consideration. Now, actually, that number, think about 15 years from now when a good number of our coal plants and the nuclear plants are up. The nuclear plants are up for relicensure, and the coal plants are due to be retired. So 15 years from now is actually the date we should be spending most of our attention on as we think about retiring the existing power infrastructure in Minnesota. This policy will help ensure that retiring power plants are replaced with wind, solar, energy efficiency, and new innovative clean energy resources before natural gas or other greenhouse gas emitting resources can be considered. Utilities will simply need to demonstrate why clean energy would not work whenever they propose to replace or add new generating capacity. It also allows for alternative generation if reliability or affordability require it. Finally, the energy optimization proposal will put money back in the pockets of Minnesota families and businesses by expanding our conservation improvement program that has made Minnesota a nationally recognized leader in energy efficiency. Electricity and natural gas savings through the SIP program result in emissions reductions equivalent to removing approximately 1.5 million passenger vehicles from the road. The governor's proposal builds on the existing conservation improvement program by allowing utilities to create new energy efficiency programs like electrification, demand response, and load management. So that we maximize savings for consumers and businesses, the Energy Optimization Act increases Minnesota's energy efficiency goal from 1.5% savings per year to 1.75% for investor-owned electric utilities. It keeps the goal of 1.5% for Minnesota's cooperative and municipal utilities and 1.0% for Minnesota's gas utilities. Minnesotans will also benefit from new electrification measures, as electric utilities will have the regulatory tools to develop and promote programs to electrify and decarbonize the transportation sector, promote energy-efficient fuel switching, and reduce the need for costly new power plants. Many Minnesotans, particularly in greater Minnesota, face hard choices: pay the electric bill or pay their rent. The governor's proposal dedicates more energy efficient resources for low-income households so Minnesotans can heat and cool their homes more efficiently and reduce their utility bills. It doubles the requirement for utilities to provide energy efficiency measures to low-income households. For example, this could mean an additional 2,000 homes in this state could benefit from weatherization improvements annually, which we could all appreciate after this challenging winter. Minnesota is known as the national leader in setting and achieving clean energy goals, and there's now an opportunity to take that leadership to a new level. These new policies will not only ensure reliable, affordable, and sustainable electricity for Minnesota, they will also give the state a cleaner, healthier environment and a strong, clean energy economy with new jobs and business opportunities across the state. Thank you again, Madam Chair and members, for having us here today, and I would be happy to respond to any questions.
Are there questions for the commissioner right now? I don't see. Oh, Representative Groffel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, good to see you again. Hope all is well. Briefly, because it's touched on in this bill, can you describe for me the Walz administration's position on existing nuclear power plants?
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, the position taken in this bill is that the existing processes for consideration of the extending the life and operations of the nuclear power plants should remain as they are. We do not propose in this bill to alter the process already in place in Minnesota statute that would guide reconsideration or any consideration of the life of those plants.
So, Madam Chair, and to the Commissioner, so I'm looking specifically on page 4, lines 22 through 25. I'll wait for you to get the bill. Can you explain to me how the language on page 4, line 22 through line 25 is not an incentive to shut down the existing nuclear power plants we currently have in our state?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, I'm looking at specifically lines 4.24 and 4.25, saying that a carbon-free resource does not include a nuclear generation facility that currently exists in Minnesota. This portion of the bill is targeted at replacement of existing energy facilities that would be retired. And so you would not logically include the existing nuclear power plants as replacements for generating facilities that are already operating, for example, a coal plant. So that's the basis for that exclusion.
Madam Chair and to the Commissioner, previously we've done uprates at these nuclear power facilities where we've been able to expand the amount of carbon-free generation at a significantly affordable price. Would that preclude that activity as well?
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, this only excludes those kinds of upgrades if they're proposed to replace an existing facility as part of the resource plan or for the replacement of that facility. If a resource plan included that as a separate process from the Clean Energy First proposal, it would not be precluded.
So, Madam Chair and to the Commissioner, so if we were to uprate, you know, Prairie Island again, and in exchange for that as part of a package, we were able to shut down a coal plant, that would not be defined as carbon-free then?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, the first, let me note that I have not seen a proposal for an upgrade that would expand the capacity of the existing nuclear power plant. So I'm taking your question as a hypothetical, speculative question rather than an actual likely prospect. But if it was proposed separately from the replacement of an existing plant, that would be considered by the Public Utilities Commission according to our normal processes.
Okay. And Madam Chair, thank you, Commissioner, and as always, good to see you. And I'll keep my speculation to a minimum, but I will speculate that House File 1956 has a better chance of becoming law, or has a worse chance of becoming law than me being named the starting quarterback for the Minnesota Vikings next fall. Oh, so that's my speculation for the day. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Baker has a question, and then we're going to
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I think as I was reading through the bill, I maybe have a question, and while the Commissioner's here, or maybe this is to Mr. Eloff, on lines 16.4, we've got the Minnesota to achieve energy savings of at least 2.5% of annual energy savings. And Mr. Eloff, as I said on the committee the last couple of years, we've always been focused on 1.5%. Is this talking about the same thing? Because I know there's another reference later on in 28.18 about 1.75 to public utilities. But what does the 2.5 mean for the state goals? Mr. Eloff or the Commissioner, I guess, whoever wants to answer that.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, the 2.5% is a statewide goal as opposed to the 1.5 and 1.75% that Commissioner Kelly mentioned is a goal for each utility that's subject to the renewable energy standard.
So, Mr. Eloff, the goal of that would be more broad-based. It's more of everything from automobiles to everything. Is that kind of all-encompassing? And how do you read that?
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, this speaks specifically to sales of electricity and natural gas, the 2.5% goal, but it would be broader than the 1.75%, which is directed specifically to electric utilities.
Okay. And thank you. And a final question for Commissioner Kelly, Madam Chair. On line 30.25, we worked on a bill, again, in the past regarding a assessment that was being done for SIP work and tracking our savings and this and that. I noticed that the Commissioner, again, has a change, or there was a $400,000 that was going to be sunsetting. We actually in the past had a private company working on that model. That sunsetted to that private company. Now I see the department's keeping the entire $850,000, and you want to do some work later on. Commissioner, is the $400,000 still maintaining needed by the department after that sunset has happened, and what would be used for that specifically, Commissioner? For that, or should that be something that we should just pull out?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, if you go over to lines 31.2 through 31.7, it identifies the activities that the department would engage in regarding developing and publishing technical information necessary to evaluate whether deployment of a fuel switching improvement meets the criteria. One of the opportunities that the department's energy efficiency potential study identified was the net energy savings that could be achieved through fuel savings, that certain forms of, for example, space heating in buildings in Minnesota are less efficient than new opportunities, for example, air source heat pumps or other technologies that have been developed in the last few years. So as part of the expansion and modernization of the Conservation Improvement Program, the department anticipates needing to develop more guidance for utilities that would implement these kinds of fuel switching and programs and new technologies to assist in that.
And Commissioner, would this be something that you would do in-house or likely farm out to another vendor to provide that information?
Madam Chair and Representative Baker, I have not discussed that opportunity with the staff at this point.
Thank you.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Commissioner Kelly. You know, just kind of looking at the bill, in kind of the terms of clean energy first, the kind of the definitions there, you know, kind of referring to integrated resource plans, current law, you know, bans nuclear, bans coal, bans most natural gas. Could you name something that the PUC has approved in the past 10 years that would have prevented, that this bill would have prevented from being put on the ground?
Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, first I want to clarify something. This bill does not ban coal, and it does not ban natural gas. Those alternatives are still available if a non-emitting source is or a solution is not feasible. Clean Energy First says you have that the utility has to demonstrate that one of these other sources, or that renewables could not solve the problem, and that they would, the only way to address the gap in their resources would be through other means, including potentially natural gas. So Clean Energy First does not ban the future deployment of natural gas in Minnesota.
Well, you didn't, I mean, so from a policy decision, right? So has the PUC under current law, I mean, would anything they've approved been stopped without this legislation? I mean, you essentially what you have in here, I mean, you're talking about, you know, pushing technology, you know, kind of overriding what the utilities are doing. You know, has the PUC flown in the face of anything that is currently in this bill?
Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, I am not aware of a specific project that would have arrived at a different outcome. However, our staff's analysis is that this language would significantly strengthen the preference that we already have in place for renewables over other sources.
Madam Chair, if Madam I may Chair. Add as well, Representative Swedzinski, the one other change the bill makes that is different from current law. In current law, there is a preference for renewable energy as the Public Utilities Commission is evaluating new sources, but there is not a preference for energy efficiency, storage, or demand-side management, which are all very affordable options. And so that's one thing that the bill updates that the Public Utilities Commission is not currently evaluating in the same way.
Madam Chair, just I'm not sure if the commission is going to be here throughout the duration or if this is kind of our chance to talk to him, but just, you know, kind of in general, you know, have you or anyone at the table actually worked on an integrated resource plan personally?
Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, I have not worked on an integrated resource plan.
Madam Chair, you know, just, you know, obviously I wasn't part of writing this bill. You know, how many people did you engage with before this bill was released as far as people that have or do write integrated resource plans to talk to them about this bill before it was released?
Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, the Clean Energy First proposal in a different form, as Representative Long mentioned, Representative Stevenson and Senator Senjum have introduced this year the Clean Energy First proposal. And my recollection is that Senator Senjum had proposed it last year. And my understanding is that people have been in discussions with the utilities about that proposal. Those utilities have prepared integrated resource plans. So at least that part of the proposal has been discussed. Secondly, the Conservation Improvement Plan we've been discussing that with utilities over a long period of time. They haven't necessarily always supported it, but my understanding is that one of the things they've always asked for is additional flexibility in how they can deploy those resources. And so this bill includes that additional flexibility.
Madam Chair, Commissioner Kelly, my question was very specific to you three as far as this particular bill as it's written and kind of what your civic engagement. I mean, I believe we all have a responsibility as ourselves, you know, if we're carrying a bill or talking about a bill to, you know, visit with the stakeholders. And, you know, I think this affects a lot of generation. And, you know, I think just from a standpoint, it doesn't sound like you guys did
personally reach out in this particular bill, maybe I'm wrong with that assumption.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Swedzinski, I'd like to hand that question to Deputy Commissioner Joe Sullivan.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski.
If you could put your name on the record, please.
My name is Joe Sullivan. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources at the Minnesota Department of Commerce. In answering that question, I would say that the language here has been vetted by the Department and by the Division of Energy Resources, and folks throughout the Department work on integrated resource plans daily. And that's, you know, they run the strategist model, they work to, you know, develop those plans with utilities, and that staff, they have seen this legislation. So, you know, to answer the question, you know, our resource planners have viewed this legislation and reviewed it.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, so that you presented this to the this bill to utilities, and they have reviewed this particular bill for weeks, or, I mean, I'm just kind of just trying to learn the process and how this bill was kind of rolled out, and so.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, in answering that question, I would, the foundational pieces of this pathway to clean energy have been worked on for more than a year with folks from the Center for Energy and Environment, from folks with the different utilities, electric and gas utilities, who have, you know, been working on these foundational pieces of the legislation. This is in no way the first time people are seeing these foundational pieces of the legislation. And I assume that when the utilities who have been, who've worked on the various components of this, that, you know, they have vetted that internally. I would also add that the overall thrust of the legislation is very utility-centric, in that we're giving the utilities a large goal that's 31 years out into the future. We're not picking winners and losers for them. We're saying carbon-free resources, and we're saying go. I mean, that's, so this is a very utility-centric piece of legislation that incorporates the planning and the analysis, the framework that they view the world through.
Thank you. Thank you. Members, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion before we adjourn, but we have 28 testifiers. We have 20 amendments. So if we do not finish this morning, we will recess and reconvene at 4:30 to finish our work. But we will start now with amendments, and I look at Amendment A1, which substitutes the year 2031 for the year 2050 for Minnesota to be carbon-free. This is moving up the time dramatically. Is there someone going to author that?
Madam Chair, just, you know, you know, you mentioned that there is, what, 28 folks that would like to testify. I know some of the amendments are mine. I would, you know, because they're amendments to change bill, I would rather hear from the testifiers first, because maybe they're testifying, what they might have to say may change the dynamic of the thoughts behind the amendments. So if we could maybe get to those folks first.
We're going to be doing the amendments first today, because the testifiers will not know what kind of bill they're testifying on. So that is our process for today. Okay. So is there someone who would like to offer A1?
Madam Chair, just in defense, you know, I know some folks potentially have driven from across the state to come here to testify. And, you know, just to be respectful to folks, because this bill is going to affect people from across the state, rather than have the amendment in the conversations now, I would just make an argument to be respectful to members of the public that may not be from around here, that we would hear from them first. But it's your committee, ma'am.
Okay. It's your decision. There are two people who have asked to testify this morning, because they won't be available this afternoon, and we will accommodate them. We will hear them after we do the amendments. So Amendment A1. Is somebody going to offer that? I don't see anyone offering A1, we will not have that today. A2? Is there someone offering A2? If people choose not to offer amendments now, we will not be hearing them again tonight. So let's...
So, Madam Chair, if they were offered as part of a larger omnibus bill, we could offer them then, or would we be prohibited from offering them then?
We can, if you want to wait and offer them as part of the omnibus bill, that's your choice, too.
Just to be clear, you're precluding the minority from offering amendments. If we hear testimony, that would influence our decision to make an amendment.
You can offer the amendments. So let's get through some of the amendments now.
Will we be marking up the omnibus bill in the same way? Well, we're going to have to offer amendments before we hear public testimony?
I don't know our process for the omnibus bill yet.
Madam Chair, it's my 15th year in the legislature. I've never heard of a bill being marked where we are prohibiting amendments from being offered once public testimony has been offered. I do not recall that on any omnibus bill or any bill of substance.
This is not an omnibus bill. This is a normal bill coming before the legislature. This is not an omnibus bill.
Well, it's your committee, but...
Representative Swasinski.
Madam Chair, I do believe, the testimony from Mr. Sullivan from the department talked about parts of these bills being foundations that have been talked about and then culminated together. I mean, I think that's kind of if you were to look up a definition, when you take separate bills that were carried by Representative Stevenson and others combined together, that this potentially has, I mean, it could be considered a renewable energy omnibus. But.
I didn't understand what point you were making. So are there amendments that will be offered?
Madam Chair, I would like to offer A1 to delete the year 2050 and insert 2031 on account of we've heard from numerous people that 12 years is our day of demise. So I would like to offer this for consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Micklin. The 12-year goal that you're referring to is from the International Panel on Climate Change, and they've said that in the next 12 years we need to reduce our emissions by 50%. They didn't say 100%. I'm very excited to see that you are pushing for 100%. That's notable and aggressive. I'd be curious to the author of the amendment why you think 100% is more appropriate than the 50% that the UN has called for.
Well, Madam Chair, I've had numerous people, well, we've heard them here, and there was even a young man in my office who makes it very clear that, we are in complete demise in 12 years. So, if this is to be such a great concern at this time, and we have, obviously, I have Sherco in my district, why not just go all in?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I commend you for your aggressiveness on climate and clean energy, but I would have to oppose the amendment because I think it goes further than what the scientists are telling us we need to do at this point.
Madam Chair, roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Representative Swasinski, did you have a comment? The clerk will take the roll, and the chair votes no.
Representative Swasinski?
Yes.
No.
Oh, no, yeah. Sorry. I used to vote for my members.
Representative Akam?
I'm confused. Can we repeat the question, please? Can you repeat, please? Yes.
The motion is... to adopt A1, and the
thank
author
you.
Of the bill has opposed the amendment.
Okay, thank you. My vote is no. Thank you. You guys confused me.
I know. Representative Baker?
I know.
Representative Bierman?
No.
Representative Bowe? No. Representative Christensen?
No.
Representative Garofalo? Representative Halverson?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mahoney?
No.
Representative Mecklen?
No.
Representative Stevenson?
There are no votes for it and 13 against it. The amendment is not adopted. Could someone offer A2?
Madam Chair, just in lieu that we cannot be swayed with these amendments or public testimony before we offer them, we're just going to pull the amendments.
Are you pulling all of the amendments? All right, that's fine. We will then start with our testifiers. Greg Mast of Clean Energy Economy. And coming up next would be Jim Nichols, former Senator and Commissioner of Agriculture. And each testifier has 2 minutes.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Greg Mast. I am the Executive Director of Clean Energy Economy Minnesota. We are an industry-led nonprofit organization dedicated to growing and strengthening Minnesota's clean energy business ecosystem. Our diverse membership is comprised of companies large and small that employ thousands of Minnesotans that work with advanced energy technologies. Today, I'm here to testify in support of House File 1956 and for strengthening our state's clean energy businesses through policy leadership. I'd like to thank Representative Long, Governor Walz, and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for taking the opportunity to move our policy leadership forward. Today, as you've heard, Minnesota is a proud home to over 59,000 clean energy jobs, and over 40% of these jobs are spread throughout greater Minnesota. Over the past year, these jobs grew at a rate twice as fast as all other sectors of our state's economy, according to the 2018 Clean Jobs Midwest Report. To spur the investments required to move Minnesota's energy system to one that is increasingly clean, secure, reliable, and affordable, stable and predictable policies are essential. This is what House File 1956 provides. Our organization supports the bill for 3 reasons. First, it will deliver improved access and opportunities for clean energy development. Second, it will modernize the electricity system for consumers. And third, it will optimize the use of cost-effective options that reduce energy waste, saving businesses and consumers money while improving the productivity of Minnesota's economy. At SEEM, we're bullish on innovation. The options contained in this bill allow for a portfolio of diverse technologies to compete that will help us maintain a reliable grid while the sector accelerates its transition to a carbon-free future. As Representative Long mentioned, yesterday our organization released the 2019 Minnesota State Energy Fact Sheet. The report, compiled in partnership with Bloomberg New Energy Finance and the Business Council for Sustainable Energy, showed that the cost of wind and solar in Minnesota continued to experience dramatic cost declines. This has helped renewables achieve a 25% share of our electricity generation mix today, and wind is our lowest cost resource. In addition, the average monthly electricity bill for Minnesota households was $97.58, 13% below the national average. And the state's leading corporations like 3M, Cargill, and Target are stepping up their efforts to procure more renewable energy to power their operations from wind and solar. And they're doing so because it makes good business sense. In closing, with more than 16 states and territories currently contemplating a transition to 100% clean energy, let's ensure Minnesota increases our competitive advantage by providing the clear policy direction necessary for attracting investments over the next decade and beyond. Thank you.
Thank you. Next will be Jim Nichols and then Isaac Orr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a handout. I'm going to give everybody a handout.
Okay. There's the page right
2 minutes. Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, Madam Chair, I gave the handout already to the page. I think she walked out there. My name is Jim Nichols, farmer from Lake Bend, Minnesota, all my life, Lincoln County, so my handouts refer to that very quickly. And I want to thank, you, Madam Chair, and Representative Houseman and Willard Munger, who's longer with us, to pass wind energy in 1994. As Ag Commissioner, I worked very hard to pass ethanol in 1991. Very quickly, as a farmer now, we produce 1.4 billion gallons of ethanol in the state. And as farmers, we deliver 500 million bushels to that local market. So it's been tremendous. Now, first page on the handout, hopefully you'll get it eventually, is we have 25 counties now that benefit from wind energy. Property taxes paid are $12 million. My own county, and it's a year out of date, is $2 million per year. And our total budget was $5 million, and we got three more projects coming. Almost all of our property taxes are going to come from wind energy in the near future. So all of our taxes have been reduced. Second page, as you know, $7.1 billion in investment. We've never had to give anything as a county or a state to get these companies to come in and invest $7 billion in the state. And as farmers now, we now receive about $15 million per year in payments. Third page, this is the contract that I have. I bought a big wind turbine, my brother and I built it on my farm, and this is our power contract, 3.3 cents per kilowatt hour. That's an actual contract. And now, then the next page is my bill from Lion Lincoln Electric Co-op. As you can see, I paid $216, 13.69 cents per kilowatt hour, and I'm producing it on my farm for 3.3 cents. It's all sold to XL Energy, and I really like wind energy as a crop because I deliver it at the speed of light to my customers. If I could use my own energy, my bill would be $52. Now we have a project that's going to be built next year in Lincoln County. They're going to provide the power for 1.5 cents per kilowatt hour. And if you could buy it at that price instead of $216, your bill would be about $26. Nothing can compete with wind for cost effectiveness. And I'll be honest, I was a little bit appalled to read an article about prices will skyrocket. Prices have gone down, and they'll continue to go down. And to address the reliability issue, Madam Chair, the last page there, that's the production from my turbine for the last 30 days. The turbine's just run. Turbine's been running for 15 years, and I've been, since we passed the law, working on wind turbines since 1994. They're incredibly reliable, and I read that article that somehow turbines had shut down when it was cold. I really can't see that happen. We never shut down when it's cold because they're like a diesel engine. You've got to keep the oil in that gearbox warm so they keep running. And then back on the reliability issue, we now have a 300-megawatt natural gas facility west of Hendricks, Minnesota, that backs up the wind. And this is going to continue. Wind is far and away the cheapest energy in the state. And we back it up with natural gas. And this thing doesn't come into effect till 2050. And we may not have enough natural gas then. But right now, you talk about oil. In North Dakota, the Bakken well field will be pumped dry in 27 years. So we don't leave much of a future for our grandkids if we don't go into some type of renewable energy. And I ask you, please, have a vision for the future, because that's what this is all about. And I'm here to support the bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Isaac Orr and then Joyce Pepin.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Isaac Orr, and I'm a policy fellow at Center of the American Experiment. And today, finally, we are releasing our report called Doubling Down on Failure, How a 50% Renewable Energy Mandate Will Cost Minnesota $80.2 billion. And the reason we decided 50% renewable energy is because a study from MIT found that 100% renewable with wind, solar, and batteries would be exponentially more expensive than a 50% renewable energy mandate. So I just want to share some of the findings from our study. This will cost each and every Minnesota household $1,200 per year and higher energy costs. Let's see here. It will increase the cost of electricity by 40%, 4.18 cents per kilowatt hour. That will increase the yearly electric bill by $375. We will not be below the national average after that. Wind turbines only last for 20 years. So when the commissioner was up here saying that, you know, a lot of our coal-fired power plants and nuclear plants may need to be relicensed, every single wind turbine that we've put in the ground, this is National Renewable Energy Laboratory statistics saying that they only last for 20 years. And we've seen that in Wisconsin and other Midwestern states. This will destroy 21,000 high-paying jobs. So when you increase the cost of electricity, that increases the cost of every good or service. The Edina Public School System uses 13.8 million megawatt hours or kilowatt hours of electricity every year. That would increase their cost by $567,000. That's 10 teachers at $56,000 a year. This will harm energy-intensive industries like mining, manufacturing, healthcare, because, let's face it, the mines up in northern Minnesota and the paper mills, use 8% of the electricity that we consume as a state every year, and the amount of global warming that would be averted by going to a 50% or 80% carbon-free would be 0.0006 degrees C of warming by 2100. This does not pass a proper cost-benefit analysis. Thank you, and that's my testimony.
Thank you so much. Joyce Pepin and then Tim Sullivan.
Good morning, Chair Ganius and members of the committee. I'm Joyce Pepin, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Rural Electric Cooperative, our association, and the rural electric co-ops we serve. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. We have several concerns with the bill. First, the increased renewable mandates do not take into consideration the limits in existing technology, nor do they provide safeguards to ensure grid reliability and stability if new technologies do not sufficiently materialize by the time we discontinue the baseload generation we've depended on for decades. And we're not alone in our concerns. The entity most responsible for ensuring grid reliability and stability is MISO, which coordinates and monitors the entire transmission system. MISO recently testified in the Senate Energy Committee that their own renewable integration assessment showed risks to grid stability as renewable energy approaches 40%. This should cause policymakers great pause. While the bill calls for PUC studies, its approach won't provide for an integrated look at regional reliability or economic impacts from a holistic perspective. Bringing in MISO to discuss the evolving grid would help ensure the proposal is workable. The bill also does not allow for carbon capture and sequestration options or provide any safety valve if sufficient technology is not developed to keep the system reliable at an affordable cost. Finally, consumer-owned utilities have been meeting for months with NGOs to modernize and improve the SIP program, but this bill is not reflective of an agreement the SIP stakeholder group made. The SIP provisions in House File 1956 are a significant step backward. One of the problems is the bill retains the current spending goal. Spending consumer dollars is not the point. Achieving the goals is the point. Another problem is the bill allows for little flexibility in developing programs over time. Allowing for innovative programs to be formulated over a longer period of time would allow for more creative offerings. The oversight section also needs work. New electrification programs should not be subject to lengthy and unneeded review prior to implementation, which can stifle creativity. For these reasons, we encourage you to give House File 1839, a bill which truly modernizes SIP, a full hearing. Thank you.
Tim Sullivan and then Greg Patton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. I'm Tim Sullivan, President and CEO of Wright Hennepin Cooperative Electric Association. We serve 53,000 consumers in northwestern Hennepin County and in Wright County. And as this committee knows, co-ops are owned by and run for the benefit of the consumer members we serve. Simply put, in our view, House File 1956 is a bad idea for our members, and it's a bad idea for the 1.7 million electric consumers served by cooperatives across the state. There are many reasons for this, but I'll focus on just two. First, the bill would do almost nothing to impact climate change. In fact, based on United Nations, US EPA, and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency data, the bill would reduce carbon emissions by just a few one-thousandths of 1%. And that's because Minnesota's electric generation is a tiny, even a minuscule contributor to total carbon emissions. So if the policy goal is effectiveness, this bill doesn't deliver even on its own terms. Second, and most importantly, the bill would have a devastating impact on electric consumers. It represents, in our view, nothing short of a first-order threat to the safety and reliability of Minnesota's grid. Now, please understand that renewables already represent 30% capacity in the Upper Midwest power pool, and that number is moving higher very quickly. And we support that greening of the grid. We very much support cost-effective renewables, but given available technology, mandated carbon-free generation at extremely high levels doesn't work because the wind doesn't always blow and the sun doesn't always shine, and we need a balance of fuels to fill those gaps. Consider the polar vortex just last month. Even if the wind had blown, wind turbines shut down at 21 degrees below zero. And during the worst of it, there was almost no wind. Our own utility-scale solar in the month of February generated 1.3% of its potential. So this mandate, had it been in place under similar brutal weather conditions, would have threatened not only the reliability but the safety and well-being of Minnesota consumers. Speaking on behalf of the 30% of Minnesota consumers served by electric cooperatives, please oppose this bill.
Greg Patton and then Joel Johnson.
Good morning, Chair Wagenius and members of the Energy Committee. My name is Greg Patton, and I'm the Director of Resource Planning and Markets for Great River Energy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on House File 1956 and share the perspective of Great River Energy and our 28 members, all of which are not-for-profit cooperatives that collectively serve two-thirds of Minnesota's communities. We are opposed to the legislation in its present form and think it's unnecessary. Minnesota already has a goal of 80% carbon reduction by 2050 in current law. Utilities know what is expected of us, and we are the only sector of the economy that is on track to meet this goal. As of 2017, Great River Energy has reduced our carbon emissions by 38% compared to 2005, and we are working to voluntarily achieve 50% renewable energy by 2030. We are very concerned about the feasibility of implementing a 100% carbon-free standard while maintaining reliability and affordability. With increased electrification of our economy, in part to reduce carbon from other sectors like transportation, we believe flexibility will be the key to reducing Minnesota's net carbon footprint. If Minnesota is going to have a carbon-related standard for electricity, it should include exceptions for peaking generation that provide key reliability with little contribution to total carbon emissions. Carbon capture is not cost-justifiable for such minimal-use resources, and peaking resources have facilitated the growth of renewable resources like wind and solar. To support around-the-clock energy adequacy, there should also be exceptions for conventional baseload generation with over 80% carbon capture and sequestration. Carbon capture technology can be developed to capture the bulk of CO2 emissions from fossil fuel plants, but it cannot capture every molecule, and such technology would be rejected by a 100% standard. We think a broad and flexible approach to carbon is needed. Just last month, we saw the value of our baseload and peaking generation in the face of extremely challenging weather conditions. Any goal should recognize the possibility that zero carbon in the electricity sector may not be technologically or economically feasible. We oppose House File 1956. We believe it is unnecessary. Electric utilities are already working towards major reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. Joel Johnson and then Kendrick Schneebel. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joel Johnson, and I'm testifying on behalf of Minn Kota Power Cooperative. Minn Kota is a not-for-profit generation and transmission cooperative that provides electricity to 11 electric distribution cooperatives and 12 municipal utilities in northwest Minnesota and eastern North Dakota. Minn Kota, like most electric cooperatives, has long opposed the use of one-size-fits-all mandates in public policy because they ignore the fundamental differences between the state's electric utilities in areas such as the size and makeup of their customer base, demand curves, business model, borrowing capacity, et cetera. And while we appreciate the extended length of time to achieve the 100% clean energy mandate in the bill, we do believe the bill's approach to moving utilities to that 100% standard is misguided and unrealistic. As I've been able to share with many of you in individual meetings, Minn Kota is looking at the possibility of adding a carbon capture unit to its Milton R. Young plant, the main source of electric generation for the cooperative. When completed, the unit could have the potential to capture between 90 and 95% of the carbon dioxide emissions at the plant. The captured carbon dioxide would then be sequestered in safe geological formations either directly below the plant or in spent oil and natural gas wells in the Williston Basin oil and gas fields. Minn Kota believes this new technology could be vital to their mission to deliver safe, reliable, affordable, and environmentally responsible electricity to its 135,000 members. The importance of that baseload power was driven home during this winter's polar vortex when demand on Minn Kota's winter peaking system reached its peak, but with its wind generation operating at far below capacity due to the severe cold. In many ways, House File 1956 represents a leap of faith. Even the utilities that have pledged to reach 100% carbon-free generation by mid-century have also admitted they don't know how they will get there, and that new technologies will need to be developed to achieve that goal. Cost-effective and efficient carbon capture and sequestration technologies could be one answer, particularly in a region like ours that will see thousands of megawatts of stable baseload power shut down over the next 15 years. We're also concerned at the additional regulatory burdens placed on utilities in the bill and potential conflicts within the MISO system when it comes to generation, dispatching, and reliability. Thank you again for allowing us to voice our concerns, and we'll be happy to answer any questions.
Madam Chair, and just this is not a question specifically to this group, but anyone that's coming up, if you could just, we talked a little bit about, you know, public engagement in the creation of this bill. If you were, if you could just answer a question, if you were engaged on particulars of this bill before it was released, 1956, whether or not that was happened, I'd appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Kenrick Scable, and I'm here speaking on behalf of Dairyland Power Cooperative. I'd like to start by stating there is no lack of commitment by the Minnesota serving utilities of transitioning to a future that incorporates more emission-free resources. In fact, there are currently nearly 70,000 megawatts of proposed wind projects in the MISO queue. However, I have serious concerns about a proposal that asks us as utilities to commit to a target that exceeds the limits of today's technology. Let me be clear. The technology as it exists today does not permit the national electric grid to operate both reliably and cost-effectively on renewable energy resources only. With that said, I understand the interest in an aspirational goal, and I appreciate that Governor Waltz has acknowledged in his proposal that a one-size-fits-all mandate is not a good approach to energy policy. And while it needs additional work, the Clean Energy First section does chart a measured and orderly transition to renewable energy through the planning process over time, as old resources are retired and new resources are added. This is a much better approach than arbitrarily setting dates that utilities must add specific amounts of renewable generation to their portfolio. The governor's proposal also acknowledges that the time has come to update and modernize Minnesota's energy efficiency program. The rural electric cooperatives and the municipal utilities have their own proposal this year. We are poised to help reduce carbon emissions from the transportation sector, which, by the way, is now the single largest carbon-emitting sector of our economy in Minnesota. I encourage you to partner with us on House File 1839 to reduce carbon emissions not only from the transportation sector, but indeed all sectors of the Minnesota economy.
Thank you. Julie Pierce and then Joe Pereira.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Julie Pierce, and I'm the Vice President of Strategy and Planning for Minnesota Power. We're a utility in the northern part of the state. Appreciate the time to give some comments today. To answer the question about the engagement on the bill, Minnesota Power was notified hours before the bill was released to let us know that it was coming. Obviously, we're very engaged in the industry and in the state, but this particular bill, we were given some hours' notice on that. So today, while we appreciate some of the elements of this proposal, we do not support the bill in its current form. And I just want to say that this is a very exciting time in our industry. We have had transformation that has been unprecedented, and this state has done some very innovative things over the past decade. And Minnesota Power, in specifically, has gone faster and farther than most as we've really taken on our transformation. 7 of our 9 coal plants have been transformed and moved away from coal-fired energy in a very short amount of time. And I would liken that to a construction project at a home or a business. We have completely remodeled the upstairs and all the bedrooms and bathrooms in terms of what we've done. But now we're looking towards the future, a cleaner energy future, and we're looking at major renovation to load-bearing walls in our house, load-bearing and new infrastructure that's needed. And that is a very important piece of our construction project that's ahead. We appreciate the governor's proposal for the longer runway. However, we have concerns that the use of mandates is not the appropriate way to do policy in the state. We can innovate through partnerships that support pillars that include reliability and affordability for our economy that relies on electric service, stable electric service, to meet our global demands of our economy. We serve some of the biggest energy-intensive companies in the state. They need stable electric reliable service. I appreciate the opportunity to talk today.
Thank you so much. Joe Perina, and then Jeff Seawall.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joseph Pereira. I'm Regulatory Director for the Citizens Utility Board. Representative, we were consulted both on the foundational bills relative as well as this bill. So we've been involved in the process for quite some time. CUB is an independent consumer energy advocate representing residential customers and small business at the legislature, the Public Utilities Commission, and in other policymaking arenas. CUB provides local communities and civic organizations with energy information to help them understand the energy transition we are undergoing. We provide Minnesotans bill consultation and advice on how they can save on energy expenditures and help them navigate the complicated energy landscape we see today. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1956. I'm here today in support because it's good for consumers, good for the economy, and good for the planet. The proposed steps laid out in HF 1956 do not put ratepayers at risk. Instead, the opportunities that this bill presents means more money in consumers' pockets. Recent McKnight Foundation study placed these savings somewhere between $600 and $1,200 annually. We have not seen opportunities for these types of savings for consumers in decades. The transition to clean energy sources offers a reverse in a long trend in which ratepayers foot the bill for large capital projects, their associated cost overruns, shareholder returns, and the constant volatility of fossil fuel prices, none of which are produced here in Minnesota, by the way. The cost of these fuels, fossil fuels, send $13 billion annually out of state. It is time that these dollars stay here in our state and pass on savings to utility customers. CUB confident Lee testifies today that the bill before this body sets an achievable goal, maintains reliability, provides utilities flexibility, and has the necessary embedded provisions to ensure ratepayers are protected. These provisions empower the Public Utilities Commission to act in the case that reliability is threatened or costs for consumers are not contained. HF 1956 also takes further steps to allow customers to control their energy use. As you've heard, there are provisions to increase SIP, and CUB is in support of these efforts. In particular, the bill doubles spending relative to the low-income provision. CUB would like to thank the chair and the committee for taking this bill up. CUB looks forward to working with the committee and all stakeholders in moving this bill forward. Thank you.
I have two questions for you. Representative Stevenson is first.
Madam Chair, actually, I don't have a question for the testifier. I just noticed that this testifier addressed Representative Swazinski's question as to both the governor's bill and the foundational bill. Other testifiers spoke only to the governor's bill, and I think that just for clarity and consistency, that if testifiers are going to address the question of their consultation, that they should speak to both the foundational bills and the governor's bill. I think that to address one or the other does not actually indicate the level of involvement that stakeholders had in the process of putting together the legislative proposal that is before the committee today.
Testifiers in the future will note that. Mecklen is first and then okay, Swazinski.
So I was just going to say if the people wanted to come back up, they could.
Madam Chair, a question for Mr. Carrera. Did you like the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, Representative Mecklen, CUB does not have a position on the A1 amendment.
Thank you.
Representative Swazinski, did you have a...
Well, Madam Chair, I was just going to say if the previous testifiers that came up and maybe didn't weren't able to speak upon that question that Representative Stevenson and myself had, could they felt like they could just have that they'd have an opportunity to do that quickly.
Thank you. So, Jeff Seawall and then Kerry Wittenberg.
Good morning, Madam Chairperson, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Seawald. I am here to testify in support of House File 1956 on behalf of Trane, brand of Ingersoll Rand. Ingersoll Rand's Minnesota footprint includes Thermo King in Bloomington and Trane in White Bear Lake. Together, these businesses employ more than 1,000 people in Minnesota. Perhaps best known for its residential air conditioning tagline, it's hard to stop a train. Excuse me. Trane develops and manufactures HVAC systems and equipment, building automation and controls applied in all types of buildings around the world. Trane's legacy in HVAC goes back more than 100 years, and in controls more than 40 years. Trane employees in Minnesota develop and deploy the company's energy management, building automation, and data analytics innovations that help U.S. commercial, institutional, and industrial building owners create, operate, and maintain comfortable and productive buildings while optimizing energy use and saving money. Our White Bear Lake facility is the headquarters for the energy services and global controls business. And our St. Paul office is the heart of our Great Northern Plains district that serves the Dakotas, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. In my work at Trane, I am part of the team that works with building owners to improve the built environment while reducing energy intensity, cost, and emissions. We work with school districts, colleges and universities, healthcare institutions, states, cities, and counties, and commercial properties and businesses across the state. Since 2007, Trane has helped save energy across Minnesota by completing more than 475 energy rebate projects in coordination with Xcel Energy Conservation Improvement Programs. These projects include cooling, heating, custom efficiency, lighting, recommissioning, and so on, and save customers nearly 40 million kilowatt hours. Thanks to conservation improvement programs, our customers look to utilities across Minnesota not only for the incentives but also for the advice and objective third-party technical review of our work. With the utilities held accountable for the energy savings reductions, they take steps to ensure that our projects do actually save energy. One example of such a project is the Science Museum in Minnesota, where Trane efficient systems save the museum more than $300,000 in operating costs year over year. Trane supports House File 1956 as a continued support for conservation improvement program and energy efficiency as the most cost-effective energy resource and most importantly, as it expands to provide opportunities to apply other cost-effective technologies such as energy storage, load shifting, and demand response. For example, Train recently worked with the City of Detroit Lakes and the Detroit Lakes Cultural Community Center to implement a thermal storage system. This summer, that system will make ice at night that will cool the facility during the day, reducing electrical demand and saving thousands of dollars annually. Thank you for bringing this bill to the committee and listening to my testimony. On behalf of Train Ingersoll Rand, I urge members to support this bill. I appreciate the opportunity to come here, and I thank you for your time and attention.
Thank you for your testimony. Carrie Wittenberg and then Ahmed Khan.
Madam Chair and members of the Energy Committee, I'm Carrie Wittenberg, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House File 1956 on behalf of Werner Electric. Werner Electric is a regional electric product distributor. We serve the Upper Midwest territories. We have 8 branches, 6 of which are located in Minnesota. We employ more than 300 people, the vast majority of those people work in our central distribution center in Cottage Grove. I work specifically with our lighting customers, but we have specialists in the areas of industrial automation, motors and drives, solar energy and battery storage, as well as providing your standard electrical objects, switching, outlets, wires, etc. SIP is an important part of Werner's sales conversations. Our lighting, motors and drive teams talk about SIP incentives with our customers as we work through our sales processes. Efficiency and clean energy are things that end users know is a good thing. It's good for the environment. Improved systems are good for employee well-being and morale, as well as their productivity. Being green is good for a company's image, and of course, it's good for a company's bottom line. However, efficient choices are less affordable than the standards. Without incentives, customers simply have no incentive to make a change. Incentives through SIP provide the reason to change and often allow the unattainable upgrade to become an affordable option for them. In my specific role, I work with customers looking to increase their lighting efficiency. LEDs, while they have dropped considerably in price over the last 5 years, are still not the least expensive option when it comes to lighting purchases. However, they provide tremendous long-term opportunity for savings. New sensing technologies that integrate with HVAC systems, for instance, can provide additional savings by shutting off cooling and heating loads when the spaces are unoccupied. The future for LEDs and sophisticated and integrated controls is quite bright. We really are just at the starting line of exploring the hardness and harnessing the possibilities of what LED lighting and controls can do. Expanding the scope of SIP will help to push that forward. Every box of Werner product that you would receive is marked with the slogan, Solutions, Supply, and Support. Efficient products are specified for projects by highly technical, skilled staff. They're packaged and delivered through our dedicated distribution center staff. I'm getting the stop sign here. Sorry, I'll wrap it up. And they're brought out to site and installed by technical and skilled tradesmen and women. SIP doesn't just impact our customers. It impacts us as well. Utility rebates through SIP help make our impact possible. Thank you for the opportunity to speak with you today. Werner Electric asks for your support of this bill.
Thank you. Ahmed Khan, and then Paul Austin.
Well, ergonomically, it would be fantastic if you just got up for a second and sat right back in. The tension in the room will be diffused a little bit. Good morning. My name is Ahmed Khan. I will offer you a different testimony today. I am the co-founder, CEO of Apadana LLC. It is a lighting company and is a solar company. My goal is to eliminate waste and figure out a way to convince the same set of customers, hopefully, to use renewable energy for their consumption. It has been fantastic. Why I got into this is I have a daughter who is a senior at the University of Minnesota studying electrical engineering. When she was 8 years old, she asked me, Dad, what have you done for my future? And she was not really looking for how much money I have in her saving account or 529 account. She wanted safety and security of the planet that we are all living in. As you may have heard, the President of France the other day coined the phrase, there is no planet B. So I wake up every morning along with my coworkers, about 40 people in the city of Golden Valley and St. Louis Park, go to work to deliver on the mission that she called me on. Challenged me when she was 80 years old, and I am forever grateful for her. The issue on hand is that everybody agrees with the LED technology and renewable. And the reason I'm supporting this particular bill is the fact that the business owners, when they go to work, they have a different problem than worrying about their lights or the sources of energy. Only few have the staff to worry about that. And incentives such as this allows us to go in and provide our customers a financially and environmentally responsible solution that secures the future of my family and all of yours. With that, I thank you, and I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Paul Austin and then Jason Braher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Paul Austin. I'm the Executive Director of Conservation Minnesota. I'm here today to speak for our network of 80,000 Minnesotans in favor of HF 1956. There are several reasons that this legislation makes so much sense for Minnesota as a strategy to reduce carbon pollution and build on our growing clean energy economy. First, the requirement that our utilities produce 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050 establishes a clear and compelling goal. Government and the private sector can work best together when we know where we're headed and have a clear destination. Second, it includes the Clean Energy First policy that our organization has worked with bipartisan partners to develop over the past 2 years. That policy, even on its own, would be Minnesota's biggest legislative step forward for clean energy and carbon reduction in over a decade. The policy will drive us continually forward as older power plants are replaced, capturing cost savings, technological gains, and pollution reductions for customers while providing the flexibility for utilities of every size to succeed. Finally, the energy optimization policies included in the package ensure that efficiency and savings for customers while beginning to expand the use of clean energy to reduce pollution across new sectors of the economy. Together, these policies are a clear path to a clean energy future for all Minnesotans. That's why I'm excited to continue our work with you, the administration, and our bipartisan partners in labor, utilities, business, nonprofits, and the legislature to make sure that we begin to address the urgent need for carbon reduction this year. Thank you.
Thank you. Jason Broher, and then Kevin Lee.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jason Bohr. I'm testifying on behalf of the Lignite Energy Council, a regional trade association whose members provide power to millions of customers in the upper Midwest. Our members currently provide affordable, reliable, and dispatchable electricity from North Dakota's lignite coal reserves while maintaining North Dakota's status as one of only 14 states recognized by the Environmental Protection Agency as meeting all applicable clean air standards. North Dakota has demonstrated it is possible to have clean air, clean water, and clean electricity from coal as part of a balanced portfolio of energy resources. North Dakota's lignite power plants are quite simply the most affordable source of thermal baseload dispatchable power in the entire MISO market. The most recent pricing data shows North Dakota's lignite plants are cheaper than even gas and nuclear power plants, all while being required to reclaim the land to the highest agricultural standards. Now, it's no secret that North Dakota and Minnesota have had disagreements regarding our respective energy policies, but that spirit of contention doesn't have to color our future together. We recognize that what people across the region crave is reliable power for their homes, affordable power for their businesses, and responsible power for their entire economies, as well as clean air, clean water, and a clean environment. Once we agree upon those goals, we can plan on how to meet them. Specifically, we see the goal that Minnesota has contemplated regarding lower CO2 emissions and tell you that we can help. You've heard from Minn Kota about the exciting work they are doing to capture CO2 from the Young Station. The members of the Lignite Energy Council support that work. We are a funding partner, but that is just one project of many that we are excited about that will reduce CO2 or make our plants more efficient. I'm also chairman of the Lignite Research Council, one of the largest coal research and development programs in the country. We have millions of dollars per year at our disposal to dedicate to the goals we know we share with you, serving the needs of current customers while planning for the needs of future generations.
However, that work is threatened by mandates that would force unproven technology into the marketplace where the costs and risks would be borne by ratepayers. If this committee wants to reduce CO2, we can help in a way that is seamless to your customers, painless to the economy, and harmless to the environment. Thank you.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question. Would you, you know, if this bill were to move forward kind of as an association, would you maybe agree with having some language in there that would include carbon capture technology deployment and things along those lines and capacity?
Absolutely. That would be one of the changes that we would recommend, is just to recognize that that's a viable solution to the concern that I think is being articulated by many members of this committee.
See no other questions. Kevin Lee and then Jessica Tichitz from the Sierra Club.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kevin Lee. I direct the Climate and Energy Program at the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today in support of House File 1956. Our governor has called climate change an existential crisis. Those words are well chosen. This problem is the defining challenge of our time, and it can feel overwhelming. And I think you can hear that in many of the things that we've heard about this bill. We hear fears about the cost of renewable energy, even when it's now cheaper to build new wind and solar generation than it is to continue to operate many coal plants. We hear about how the wind doesn't always blow, but we don't hear about how we can interconnect widely dispersed generation and effectively make it into a baseload resource. We hear about how it gets cold in Minnesota, which is, of course, true. It shut down about 7,000 megawatts of wind in the recent polar vortex. It also shut down 15,000 megawatts of coal and natural gas fired generation. The cold doesn't discriminate against clean energy. It's a challenge for us all. It's of course true that modernizing our grid presents challenges. No one disputes that. As we build out this grid, our first priority will be safety and our second will be reliability, just as it is for every utility in the state, including Xcel, which would not commit to a 100% clean grid if it believed that it was impossible or unreliable. But even though this is about an overwhelming challenge, it's about much more than climate change. It's about cleaner air and reducing healthcare costs. When we reduce the number of hospitalizations from asthma attacks near coal plants, we save people money. And those savings don't show up on your electricity bill, but they are real dollars saved by real families. It's about the security of having a decentralized power grid that is less vulnerable to those that would seek to harm us. That, too, will never show up on your electricity bill, but it is no less real and no less important. It's about unleashing technological innovation and investments in workers all across the state. We're grateful for the support of this committee and the vision of this administration, and we're eager to get started on this important work. Thank you.
Thank you. Jessica Tritch, and then Patsy Foster-Bolton. We're going to have three more testifiers, members.
Great. Hi, everyone. My name is Jessica Tritch. I'm with the Sierra Club. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members, for the opportunity to testify today. The Sierra Club is the nation's oldest and largest grassroots environmental organization. In Minnesota, we represent 80,000 members and supporters empowered to protect our communities by addressing our state's most urgent environmental issues. We've been hearing from folks all around the state. They are excited and want to see our state powered by 100% clean and equitable energy. We want to thank Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan and this committee and Representative Long for responding by setting a clear vision of 100% carbon-free energy and proposing first steps to protect our climate, increase local family-sustaining jobs, and ensure this transition to clean energy benefits all communities and families around the state. One Minnesota path to clean energy future, House File 1956, builds upon Minnesota's success reducing our reliance on fossil fuels while growing Minnesota's clean energy jobs. We are excited to see a 100% carbon-free energy standard, a 100% carbon-free electricity standard, which we can meet with clean, renewable energy. We need to set a standard to help utilities plan for a carbon-free future. Strengthening of Minnesota's existing preference for clean energy over fossil fuels when meeting new electricity needs It's critical that we meet new energy needs with renewable energy and energy conservation as we transition away from fossil fuels in order to stop the rush to frack gas that is risky for our climate and for customers, especially as economics keep improving for clean energy. We want to support local clean energy jobs and prevailing wages for large new clean energy projects. As we transition to clean energy, we need to ensure that the clean energy economy strengthens workers and communities in Minnesota. Increasing energy efficiency, investing in energy efficiency creates jobs, lowers electricity bills, and reduces the need to generate more electricity. It's a key ingredient for our clean energy future, and as we've been hearing in this committee, there is significant potential for more energy savings in our state. We support increasing the energy efficiency standard for investor-owned utilities and increasing energy savings assistance for low-income households. And developing beneficial electrification programs. As our electric utilities continue to reduce carbon emissions, electrifying buildings and transportation can help us reduce emissions across sectors. By moving these policies forward, Minnesota can take critical steps forward on our path to 100% clean energy future. We are excited to support House File 1956. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Backlund.
Sorry.
Madam Chair. Does the Sierra Club support the first Amendment A1?
While we do think that we can meet the 100% carbon-free goal before 2050, we have no position on that particular amendment.
And one follow-up, Madam Chair. Was the Sierra Club consulted in putting together this bill prior to?
We were consulted in the foundational bills before they were introduced.
Thank you.
Patsy Foster Bolton, and then Steve Klemmer.
Hi, my name is Patsy Foster Bolton. I'm a resident of Minnetonka, a leader with Isaiah, but the most important role of my life is mom. As parents, we have kids knowing that they will always come first. It starts the day I knew I was pregnant. I understood, and as moms do, and we, as parents, that they are a part of every choice we make for the rest of our life. Where we work, where we live, the food we eat, the friends we have, the financial choices we make, all were made to ensure a better future for our sons, who are now old enough to have children. So naturally, I started nagging them about grandchildren. My oldest told me he felt it unethical for him to bring a baby into this world knowing the threat we are facing with climate change. This was eye-opening and disheartening. As parents, we make choices about how we live and what we do to protect our children and to give them the best future we can. That's why I'm leading for 100% clean energy, which is HF 1956, and hope you all support this bill. I want to know that I did all I could to give my kids and all our kids a chance, not just to survive, but to thrive. I want my kids to decide for themselves the future they want without fear about climate change. We owe this to them. Thanks.
Thank you. Steve Klemmer.
Good morning. My name is Steve Klemmer. I'm the Director of Energy Research for the Union of Concerned Scientists. UCS is the nation's leading science-based nonprofit organization with more than 500,000 supporters, including 7,200 in Minnesota. I would like to thank Representative Woodgenius and the other members of the committee for the opportunity to testify today in support of HF 1956. I would also like to applaud Governor Waltz for his leadership in proposing this bold initiative to achieve 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050. In answer to the question from Representative Swedzinski, I was aware of some of the policy ideas that are included in this bill, but not consulted directly on the bill. So recent reports by the world's leading scientists show that there is an urgent need to achieve deep cuts to limit the worst impacts of climate change. Last October, a United Nations report concluded that the goal of keeping global average temperatures from rising above 1.5 degrees Celsius will require reaching net zero emissions by mid-century. A month later, the fourth National Climate Assessment presented the starkest assessment starkest assessment to date of the national consequences of climate change. The report projected that the U.S. economy could lose more than 10% of its value by century's end and could cost the Midwest $10 billion in public health impacts, lost agricultural productivity, and other expenses. I share Governor Waltz's comments about that there is a moral responsibility to deal with this problem and that we owe it to our children and future generations to deal with that. And most importantly, states are play an important role in leading the way to accomplish this. HF 1956 will help Minnesota achieve these emission reductions while maintaining its national leadership in deploying renewables and efficiency. It has been more than a decade since Minnesota passed major climate and energy legislation. Since the Next Generation Act was passed in 2007, several states have committed to increasing renewables to more than 50% by 2030 and achieving 100% low carbon electricity by 2050, as this bill does. Many other states are actively considering these policies. One recommendation that we would have for improving this bill would be to set interim targets for increasing renewables and reducing emissions. Interim targets are needed to continue the state's clean energy momentum and to compete with other states to attract new clean energy jobs. To put the U.S. on a pathway to net zero emissions by 2050, climate scientists tell us we need to achieve nearly half of those reductions in the next decade. To address Representative Meekland's comment there. Interim targets also send a clear signal to industry to ensure that these near-term reductions are met. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just kind of, you kind of touched on Representative Meekland's potential question, but kind of just from a science standpoint, what reduction in temperature will this policy in the state of Minnesota mean globally? Like, what impact will we have on a global scale from a temperature standpoint?
I don't know the answer to that question, but basically to address this issue and keep temperatures from rising above 1.5 degrees Celsius, the whole world has to need to act to reduce emissions in line with achieving net zero emissions by 2050. The U.S. and all the rest of the industrial countries have to take actions to achieve those goals. And Minnesota is a leader on these issues and can play an important role in terms of committing to reduce its own emissions as well as to encouraging other states to follow suit.
Madam Chair, thanks again for your testimony. Sure. Just kind of a follow-up. In previous hearings, we had research come before the committee that said essentially, even if we cut carbon emissions globally 100% tomorrow, we would still see increases in temperature. Do you agree with that assessment?
Yes, the emissions that we put up into the atmosphere stay there for a period of time, and so we can't completely avoid the impacts of climate change, but we can avoid some of the most severe impacts by reducing emissions and keeping temperature increases below 2 degrees Celsius, as was called for in the Paris Climate Accord, as well as trying to lower them to 1.5 degrees. There's actually quite a bit of a difference in between. Even though it doesn't sound like much, a half a degree temperature increase has major impacts in terms of drought, sea level rise, storm surge, extreme weather events, and so forth. On the climate, and certainly we are not on track to even keep temperatures under 2 degrees C, which is why there's a really urgent need to act in the next decade to drive emissions down.
You know, you kind of spoke a little bit about it, the 10-year kind of time frame. Do you feel like the end world will end potentially if we do not take that action in 10 years?
The world is not going to end, but the costs of not meeting those targets and the impacts on our environment, especially disadvantaged communities and countries that are more susceptible to sea level rise and so forth, are going to have significant consequences that result from it. And so, so we need to start reducing emissions immediately to get on that pathway to achieving net zero emissions by 2050.
And Madam Chair, just a final question. Kind of, you know, it's been brought a couple times. The previous testifier talked about their child feeling that it's ethically irresponsible for them to have children and bring them into this world. I mean, do you think that's a good policy decision, or kind of a, do you think we should encourage that kind of thinking, or kind of what are your thoughts along those lines?
We do not take that position. I certainly haven't taken that position. Certainly, we all need to be careful about reducing our consumption and having our carbon footprint and other environmental footprint on this planet.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
We have 15 people left to testify, and so this division will recess and reconvene at 4:30 in this. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't see your.
Yes, Madam Chair, just before we recess, just kind of a, did we have a fiscal note being prepared for this bill, and potentially do you think it will be ready to go before we come back in?
We can talk to our fiscal analyst.
Madam Chair, Representative Swedzinski, a fiscal note has been requested, but it is not, I don't have a deadline for when it will be finished.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Okay.
We now are in recess. Members, we're going to reconvene Energy and Climate Finance. We established a quorum this morning, but we didn't approve the minutes. Representative Stevenson, would you move approval of the minutes of March 7th?
Madam Chair, I move the minutes from our last meeting.
Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes of March 7th, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposition? The minutes are approved. Members, the bill we are hearing is House File 1956, which is being laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. We were working on a list of folks who had signed up for comment, and we will get right to it. Kent Sulem from Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, and on deck, Iman Asadzaman. And yes, I would remind everybody, since we have so many testifiers, that to be fair to everyone, we are asking for 2 minutes only, and you will see notice up here when your 2 minutes are up. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Ken Sulem with the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. To address the questions that were asked this morning, no, we were not consulted about the bill as a whole. We were very instrumental in working with various groups such as CEE and others on SIP reform. The language that's in here is not our SIP language. It's comparable in format, and much of the terminology is the same, so I'm assuming there's some sharing of information as the drafts were going forward. We were notified that they were working on a SIP provision, but we did not have input directly on it. That's the section of the bill that I am going to primarily focus on this afternoon, because there's a lot of things that have changed from what the approach we were trying to take. There's a lot more musts in the language rather than mays and guidance. There's a number of things that are a little more prescriptive as to what has to be accomplished in order to get credit, which in our opinion is stifling of innovations that may occur if the utilities had more wiggle room to prove what they're trying to do, to outline in a plan. And our proposal had been a 5-year plan. This provides for a cap of 2 years. But we would be required to show what's happening in the 5-year plan, annual updates, why, if there's any issues with the plan, we'd identify what they are. None of that is in this bill, but other prescriptive language is. There's a new provision on waivers that would prohibit any waiver below a 1% efficiency rate. That is a new provision. That had not been really debated. It retains the arbitrary expenditure requirements, which had been by all sides agreed were not necessary and actually not at all productive. It mandates the use of fuel switching, not just authorizing it and giving the flexibility to the locals. It actually says you shall have a plan for fuel switching, which for some of our folks may be a problem. There's cost-effectiveness language that, frankly, to comply with would cost more than any cost-effectiveness we'd gain from the provisions. And so in that regard, because of these prescriptive provisions and the provisions that actually take a step back from where negotiations were, we do oppose this bill. I want to make one last comment, and that is this is a 30-year lookout, but for utilities, that's really only two contract cycles. Most purchase agreements are between 15 and 20 years, so when you're thinking about what we have to commit to now to get to 30 years out, it's a real challenge. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Iman Asad Zeman, and on deck, Anna Grace Hottinger. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, representatives, good afternoon. I'm Imam Asad Zaman, Executive Director of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota. I urge you to approve the Clean Energy Pathway Bill, House File 1956. I am so glad that Minnesota is finally talking about and leading the clean energy pathway. I'm here to voice my support for 100% clean energy by 2050. Climate change is an urgent threat, and it must be treated as such. I know that together we can build a more just, equitable economy based on renewable energy like solar and wind. I am an American by choice. That means I was not born in this country. I chose America, and America accepted me as a citizen. I was born in Bangladesh, a land already impacted deeply by climate change. With 150 million people, Bangladesh is one of the most densely populated places on Earth. It has half the people of America on half the land of Minnesota. I don't want my new homeland to also suffer like my previous homeland. Instead of that, we can take this as an opportunity to build a new economy built around clean energy. That is why we must act now for 100% equitable and clean energy, and we have a once-in-a-generation opportunity to ensure the well-being of those whom we love today and to secure a healthy future for our children and grandchildren. Black, brown, or white, rural or urban, every gender, every age, we will all benefit from a more equitable, more healthy, and more sustainable energy system. Let us make clean energy a priority for and for making Minnesota a leader again. Please approve Clean Energy Pathway Bill, House File 1956. Thank you.
Thank you. Anna Grace Hottinger, and coming up next, Danny Steele.
Hi, Chair Rodriguez and members of the committee, and thank you for having me today. My name is Anna Grace Hottinger, and I'm 16 years old. I'm here from Minnesota Can't Wait, a youth coalition of youth putting together climate change on the table and making it the urgent matter it must be. If we don't take action now, it's my generation's future that is at risk. But the generation that is already here matters too. This fall, my sister, Mary Claire, was impacted by the California wildfires, and the community around her went down in flames. This is already a reality for many. Homes are being burnt down, hurricanes are happening more often and more intensely, and even outside we can see the changes in our own state. Though we may not always recognize the signs of climate change, they are there. The action we take, though, is for our sisters, our brothers, our cousins, our neighbors, and your kids. This is One Minnesota. Our future must be built so that every one of us are guaranteed justice, equality, and a fair economy. This isn't a Republican issue. It's not a Democratic issue. It's nobody inside or outside the lines. It's an everybody issue. It's an issue we all share. Every baby, every elderly person, every child, every plant, every molecule of water. But by making this change, we are providing a step closer to hope for our futures and health depend on this. And making this change will make a ginormous leap in the piece of the puzzle of what's needed for a livable future for all to come and all that are already here. That is why I'm here today, to support this bill for 100% clean energy. It's a big step forward, and I look forward to working with legislators here and our governor to make Minnesota 100% clean energy and equitable for all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Danny Steele and then Justin Fay.
Good evening, Chair Wagenius and members of the committee. I thank you for having me tonight. My name is Danielle Steele. I'm 17 years old, and I'm a senior at the School of Environmental Studies. I am here as a representative for the Minnesota Can't Wait movement, which Anna Grace described perfectly. We are youth making the solutions to climate change as big as the crisis. Climate change is dire to address now, because we are already starting to see the disastrous effects that humans have expedited. I speak not only for myself, but for my friends, my family, my generation, and future generations, so that we may have a bright future without a massive dependency on fossil fuels. Like most of us today, I depend on fossil fuels for a majority of what I use in my daily life. I drive a hand-me-down Toyota Highlander that is almost as old as me, that is dependent on gas and oil to run. I live in an older industrial part of Eagan, near Mendota Heights, where the house is dependent on fossil fuels too. My parents rent the property. Therefore, we don't have as much control over our source of energy. There are not any green energy transitions I can make that are currently available to change my consumption of fossil fuels. I cannot afford a brand new electric vehicle. I cannot change how our house runs. However, I can support the One Minnesota Clean Energy Package that will help make these transitions and green jobs more widespread and available to communities like mine in the future. As the end of high school is nearing, I'm about to start a new journey. I plan on attending Northern Michigan University for the next 4 years to obtain a degree in environmental science. And my dream job after this is to become a park ranger, either in a national forest or a park here at home in Minnesota. Minnesota is home for me. It always will be. It's where my family is and the natural spaces I love. I am being as active and persistent as I can be to make needed change happen to protect our future. We cannot continue to depend on fossil fuels. It is destroying the planet. Give us all a future. We are one Minnesota for clean and green energy. To quote my favorite story, unless someone like you cares a whole awful lot, nothing's going to change. It's not the Lorax.
Thank you all so much. Justin Fay and then Michelle Dreyer.
Good afternoon, I suppose it is now, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. My name is Justin Fay. I'm here on behalf of Fresh Energy. Fresh Energy is a 25-year-old Minnesota-based energy policy nonprofit working to achieve realistic, visionary energy policies that benefit all Minnesotans. We appreciate the opportunity to share a few brief thoughts with you today regarding the significant legislation that's in front of the committee. Minnesota's existing renewable energy standard was signed into law in 2007. Widely considered ambitious and nation-leading at the time, Minnesota has achieved the goal of 25% renewable energy years ahead of schedule. We believe it's time now to update the policy direction that we're providing to utilities, state regulators, and stakeholders. The 100% carbon-free standard included as part of Governor Walz's One Minnesota Path to Clean Energy represents a clear effort to craft policy with a high level of flexibility for Minnesota's electric utilities. And the governor's language sets a vision that is clear and unambiguous while remaining technology neutral and non-prescriptive. While Fresh Energy believes that Minnesota's existing renewable energy standard framework has and will continue to serve our state well, we also believe that Governor Walz deserves broad acknowledgement for his effort to develop an approach that works for the widest possible set of stakeholders. Energy optimization, clean energy first, transmission planning, and local hiring are all important objectives on their own merits. And we appreciate the effort that has gone into developing the components of the proposal that's in front of the committee today. The flexible long-range target for eliminating carbon at its center, we believe that House File 1956 contains the pieces that are needed to set Minnesota on the right path to securing carbon reductions while doing right by our utilities, workers, and other parties. Fresh Energy thanks Governor Walz, Lieutenant Governor Flanagan, and the authors of component pieces of the bill, Representative Long and Representative Stevenson, for their leadership, and we stand ready to assist as this conversation moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Michelle Dreyer and then Christy Rosenquist.
Madam Chair, members of the Energy Committee, my name is Michelle Dreyer and I represent the Minnesota Electrical Association. The Electrical Association is an organization of 400 electrical contractors and electrical employers and provides education and government advocacy for its membership, most of whom are small employers throughout the state of Minnesota. I am testifying in support of the Governor's Energy Bill, House File 1956, specifically in regards to increasing the investor-owned utility conservation improvement plan minimum to 1.75% from 1.5%. The increase of funds for energy efficiency projects will increase work available to small business across the state, as well as reduce burdens on the grid. SIP provides a mechanism to reduce the time frame of return on investment to incentivize energy efficiency projects instead of continuing operations with less efficient equipment. Energy efficiency projects provide income for our contractor members and product service members alike. An increase in SIP goals will increase energy efficiency-related jobs that are critical to small businesses, especially in rural Minnesota. The increase would also increase the amount of efficiency projects proposed by investor-owned utilities, increasing the effectiveness of SIP and reducing members' energy costs. Additionally, strategic electrification is a smart use of resources, especially as a larger percentage of Minnesota's electrical power is generated from renewable energy. Allowing for fuel switching as part of energy efficiency to take greater advantage of renewable resources, eliminating reliance on fossil fuels, and further driving energy efficiency projects. Benefits our environment and economy. Committee members, I ask you to support the increase in SIP to increase energy efficiency projects and also support small business while benefiting consumers. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Christy, oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Thank
you, Madam Chair.
We have more than one set of eyes up here.
Oh, it's all good. It's all good. Don't worry about it. Just, Madam Chair, members, just kind of a, just a general question. You talked a little bit about the SIP program and the increase. You know, have any idea what that would mean from an economic standpoint, from investment, from moving it from 1.5 to 1.75?
I do not. I'm not an energy expert. I'm only speaking to my small business members.
Madam Chair, and just maybe a question. I know there's a lot of provisions talking about prevailing wage. Would that prevailing wage section move into any SIP changes as well?
I can answer that, Madam Chair. Representative Wozinski, no, the prevailing wage is specific to wind projects over 25 megawatts.
Madam Chair? Why?
Madam Chair, Representative Wozinski, so I think the goal is to try to look at large projects that are going to be having a significant workforce, and that was a line that we drew. If you were interested in expanding that line, I'd be open to the conversation.
Oh, Madam Chair, just kind of what was your reasons for drawing that line other than the size of the project?
Well, the reason for drawing the size line was the size of the project, so I think 25 megawatts is a large-scale wind development, and the thought was that projects over that size are going to be able to help invest in making sure that we have good-paying jobs in Minnesota for wind projects.
Madam Chair, so smaller than that, they're not able to invest and make good-paying jobs?
Madam Chair, this bill does not address smaller projects. I would certainly hope that projects that are smaller than 25 megawatts would be open to a conversation about prevailing wage, but that's not the intent of this bill at this point.
Okay.
Thank you. And thank you, Ms. Dreyer.
Thank you.
Next is Christy Rosenquist and then Joel Smith. I don't see Christy Rosenquist, so we'll go to Joel Smith and then Rick Evans.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Joel Smith. I'm here today on behalf of Liuna, Minnesota, and North Dakota, a union of more than 12,000 proud men and women who build and maintain our state's transportation, water, energy, and building infrastructure. I want to thank the Chair and Representative Long, along with Representative Stevenson, for the chance to share our thoughts on House File 1956. We are here today to express our support for the goals that HF 1956 sets out to accomplish, and our appreciation for the inclusion of labor standards designed to ensure that new clean energy investments create high-quality jobs for Minnesota workers. We are also here to urge the committee to restore language from Representative Stevenson's bill that provide a path to utility ownership of wind, solar, and storage built to replace retiring power plants. Liuna members know a little bit about power. For decades, our members have worked alongside building trades brothers and sisters to construct and safely maintain Minnesota's fleet of conventional and nuclear power plants. And employment of members in the wind and solar industry is growing. I personally spent 23 years in the field as a laborer in XL Energy power plants. Minnesota is a national leader when it comes to electric power. Our electric rates are below the national average. Minnesota utility sector is also a leader in deployment of wind energy and reducing consumption of coal. Minnesota's success is founded on strong utility regulations. Our success is also based on partnerships with utilities. Our success depends on skilled union workforce that has kept the system reliable and affordable while providing middle-class paychecks, comprehensive health benefits, and retirement security to thousands of families across Minnesota. Liuna, Minnesota, and North Dakota recognizes that climate change possesses a clear and present danger, and we believe that the time is to act is now to replace conventional power plants. HF 1956 sets what we think is an achievable goal of 100% carbon-free electricity by 2050 and establishes a strong reference to clean energy. Equally important, the bill ensures that Minnesota workers and communities are not left out or left behind. In recent years, we have seen the promise of clean energy jobs fall short, and our members have watched renewable energy projects being built by out-of-state workers and not non-responsible contractors. HF 1956 recognizes the need to consider the impact of energy projects on local workers and support the creation of high-quality jobs. Finally, it's the right thing to do for our planet by creating a path of utility ownership of new clean resources. We can help accelerate the national trend towards clean power by showing the electric utility industry the commitments like XL aren't just good for the planet, they're also good for business. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Swazinski has a question for you.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, if you'd just take a second, sorry. We talked the last conversation was a little bit about kind of that drawn line for prevailing wage above 25 megawatts. I mean, do you guys have a position on moving that down to just every single project within this bill? So the SIP program, the rest, you know, maybe it's solar gardens. Does your union have a position on moving that throughout the bill?
Well, I think we support the bill way it's written with the prevailing wage in it.
Okay, so you don't think it should be expanded past that those lines at all?
We think the threshold that's there is acceptable.
Okay.
Thank you. Rick Evans, and then Jigme Ugin.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans with XL Energy. As a public utility, XL Energy is committed to universal access to electric power with non-discriminatory pricing. And as of last December, under the direction of our CEO, Ben Folk, we are also committed to achieve an 80% reduction in carbon emissions by 2030 and aspire to a 100% carbon-free system by 2050. That commitment applies not only to Minnesota, but to the customers we serve in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Michigan, Colorado, Texas, and New Mexico. The commitment has not changed in any respect since it was made by our CEO last December. This will be a massive and complex undertaking, but we believe that XL Energy, operating under the supervision of the Public Utilities Commissions in those states where we serve, is uniquely situated to achieve these goals faster, more economically, and more reliably than anyone else can. We've already demonstrated this. Since 2005, XL Energy has reduced carbon emissions on its system twice as much as Germany, which is often held up as a model in the world. We believe that Minnesota law already gives the Public Utilities Commission, gives the Public Utilities and the Public Utilities Commission all the authority needed to achieve these goals. But we do appreciate the work that Representative Stevenson and Representative Long have done to try to move that partnership forward. We believe that those efforts will pay off and that we will be able to build a true partnership between the utilities and the state as we work to pursue these goals. But in the course of the last few weeks in this legislative session, we find there are still many important and unresolved issues and decisions that will need to be made. We have yet to deal with the alignment of the contribution of existing nuclear fleet to the goals that we can make in this effort. We have yet to talk about the contribution of distributed energy resources, and we have really not talked about the future role of public utilities in this work. House File 1956 contains some very good ideas, but more work is needed. Today, we urge the committee to lay this over and to use the interim before the 2020 legislative session to continue this work. In the best tradition of Minnesota policy, we can work together with all the stakeholders and policymakers to craft a good approach. Xcel Energy has already started this process. Our resource plan that will be filed in July will start us down the path to the goals that our CEO has laid out for us. It will start in July a detailed and extensive conversation on the regulatory process and provide the legislature with valuable insight into how this resource plan statute can be amended to facilitate the common goal. We stand ready to work with the committee and the legislature to accomplish that. Thank you.
Representative Garofalo has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Evans. Mr. Evans, I think some members of the committee may be under the mistaken impression that perhaps, you know, if the legislature were just to pass this law, there's no harm in it. After all, if Xcel has the same shared goal of reducing carbon emissions, as I think the vast majority of us do, that there'd be no harm in doing that. But I think there's a previous example in statutes where we've actually had statute get in the way of developing affordable clean energy, and that's the community solar garden statute. Would you mind just taking a minute and explaining to the committee how that example of how it's been disruptive to the community solar garden statute has been disruptive to expanding the amount of affordable renewable energy? And how that, and draw upon that some comparisons to how that could be applied to this bill.
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, just briefly, as we go through the resource planning process, we propose to build solar energy at the lowest cost through a process where we find contractors who can build it. We also are required under state law to take all of the community solar gardens energy that we that is offered to us at the price set by the PUC, which is extremely high compared to other solar resources that we could buy. And so, for example, in our last resource plan where we proposed 600 megawatts of solar energy, we were instructed by the PUC not to build any of it because they knew that the solar gardens energy was coming through the system and through the pipeline, that we were not able to turn it down and that we were going to have to pay that high price. And so they instructed us not to go buy the cheaper solar energy. That's just one of the ways where, as we talk about distributed resources, solar gardens, rooftop solar, solar on schools, and all of these things which have a place in our system but really are not coordinated with the resource plan, which is the statute that we're dealing with in this bill, and we would like to have that discussion.
And Madam Chair, if I have a follow-up. So, Mr. Evans, your testimony is that while well-intentioned, and I have no doubt that when the community solar statutes were put in place that people had the best of intentions, that the net result of that has been zero difference in the amount of carbon emissions, because after all, Xcel wanted to build that solar anyways, and the effect of it was the Public Utilities Commission ordering you, instead of allowing you the flexibility to purchase affordable solar, it mandated that you purchase expensive solar. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Representative Swasinski has a question for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Mr. Evans, what percentage of the electricity that's used in the state of Minnesota does your company produce? And
we serve approximately 50% of the customers in Minnesota. I believe our share of the energy is slightly higher than that, but I'll have to get back to you with the answer to that question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then how many, over your career, how many resource plans do you think you've played a part in or been around?
Madam Chair and Representative Swasinski, resource planning requires a computer, and no one is going to trust me to do that, so I play no role in any of them. But we do them every 2 or 3 years.
2 or 3 years. So I'm going to guess you've probably been around for 10 or 15 or
17 on Sunday.
17 on Sunday. So, you know, I think that's, you know, that speaks volumes, just the amount of electricity a company like this produces and as far as customers and what they're being asked to do through the PUC. You know, how's the conversation gone? You know, this bill kind of has been moving forward. Obviously, some parts of it have been seen a little bit, but kind of how those conversations happened between you as, you know, one of the largest producers in the state and understanding electricity probably better than any of us in this room.
when it comes to resource plans. You know, what is that? How's that gone? What's the, you know, what's been your reaction?
Well, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we started quite early in the session working with Representative Stevenson and a group of stakeholders that he had pulled together from the environmental community, from organized labor, from the independent power producers, and worked a lot on the bill that he was working on. The bill has taken a turn on us a little bit here, and that is a matter, has raised some concerns, you know, especially in terms of how we address some of these broader resource planning questions. So, you know, I'm here every day that the legislature is here, and I think I have a good working relationship with everybody in the legislature and the staff. And so, you know, we continue to work with everybody, but, you know, we've all been through this process, and we know it takes some work.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Evans, going back to the question on the solar gardens that was just referenced, can you tell me what percentage of the energy you received or generated from solar gardens?
If the question is to the amount of energy we receive,
right?
I want to say that
I say the question would be in the percentage of all the energy you generate. How big is that section?
I want to say 2%. A little less than that. A little less than 2%.
If you could get back to us with that exact number, we'd appreciate it.
I will do that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you so much. Jigme Ugam, and then Alan Mueller.
Good evening, Chair Wagenius, members of the committee. My name is Jigme Ugam. I'm the Executive Vice President of SCIU Healthcare Minnesota. We are a union of over 35,000 members, healthcare members, workers across the state. I'm also a Tibetan refugee. My country, Tibet, contains the biggest ice fields outside of the Arctic and Antarctic. The scientists are predicting that the glaciers in Tibet will melt away by 2050, and Tibet could probably disappear by 2090. My country is suffering because of other people's greenhouse gas emissions elsewhere in the world. Climate change is real, and it is the biggest threat facing our world today. Our members at SCIU Healthcare Minnesota moved a resolution to address climate change and environmental justice. Because as healthcare workers, our members know firsthand the impact of public health risk, environmental pollution, extreme weather events like forest fires and flooding. Because as a labor movement, we need fair and just transition for impacted communities and workers dependent on fossil fuel industry. Because as people of color and as immigrants, our members are amongst those disproportionately hardest hit. Because as parents and grandparents, they are committed to leaving behind a safer and cleaner planet. And because as a community, we do not have to choose between a healthy economy and a healthy environment. Our families and our economy and our communities can and should have both. On behalf of SCIU Healthcare Minnesota membership, I applaud Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's thoughtful and comprehensive approach to reaching 100% clean energy by 2050. Please support House File 1956. It will not only transform Minnesota towards a thriving economy and a healthy future, it will probably also contribute towards saving my country from extinction. Thank you.
Thank you. Alan Mueller and then Chris Schoenher.
Is this working? I guess it is. Madam Chair and representatives, my name is Alan Mueller. I'm a resident of Red Wing, Minnesota, and I represent Neighbors Against the Burner and myself. I think there's no doubt that climate change is, as other people have probably pointed out many times, is the most serious threat that humankind faces. So I commend those people here and Governor Walz for making this a higher profile issue in Minnesota. At the same time, there isn't any question that it's proven very difficult to enact and implement meaningful legislation to address this problem. And so when we look at this piece of legislation or any other, it behooves us to make sure that we move ahead with something that is actually likely to be beneficial with regard to abating climate-changing emissions, and that doesn't have the effect of creating additional pipelines into utility ratepayers' pocketbooks without any benefit except to the bottom line of those utilities. The first three times I read this bill and took notes on it, it struck me as being very much, having very much the semblance of an Xcel Energy work product. And having listened this morning to the testimony of Minnesota Power, whose representative said they'd only seen the bill a few hours before it was dropped, and the comments of other parties who appeared to have had a very token role in this bill, I feel more strongly about this. Now, a couple of questions. Xcel has reportedly has said publicly that it intends to voluntarily move to carbon-free electricity by 2050. So it's reasonable to ask, why do we have a bill that specifies something that the leading utility in the state has said it intends to do anyway? And why do we have various features of a bill that appear to me to be rate-raising initiatives, creating incentives for something that apparently doesn't need to be incented because it's already to be happening voluntarily? So that's a concern. Now, the earlier version of this, an antecedent of this bill, had a provision which is very valuable to us to take garbage incineration off the list of sources of renewable, clean, eligible energy. And although that is mentioned in the summary of the bill before us, I don't find it in the language of the bill. Now, maybe I'm missing something, but I feel that that language has been taken out and needs to go back in. And I'm seeing a stop sign, so I'll stop.
Thank you so much. Chris Schoenherr and then David Schaefer.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to testify before you today. My name is Chris Schoenherr, and I represent the Southern Minnesota Municipal Power Agency. We are a wholesale energy provider to 18 municipal utilities across Minnesota. I'll focus my comments on the carbon-free energy standard provision of the bill. While SMPA is supportive of reducing our carbon footprint overall, we remain opposed to mandates due to the potential upward pressure on the market prices for the qualifying generation sources. That said, we do appreciate the longer glide path and the flexibility and the timing of meeting this standard that's contained in this bill. SMPA has a diversified generation portfolio. The natural gas-fired engine plants are small, and they run a relatively few hours each year, but they do an excellent job of complementing our renewable resources, primarily wind and solar. During the polar vortex, which I know we're all tired of hearing about, our member utilities ran their small diesel generation for 30 hours straight. That's an unusual event. Aside from testing, they probably ran more in that couple of days than they'd run in the last 5 years cumulatively. But the fact that they could run at a time when we needed them desperately because supplies of gas and other electric generation were scarce may have helped avert a very dangerous situation. I know there are those who are very confident that we'll have new alternative technology that can be developed over the next couple of years or next couple of decades that will provide the same generating flexibility that those units do today. And I sincerely hope that they're right. But I think we should at least contemplate the cost of the question of at what cost. And what I mean by that is the challenge of transitioning our generation mix shares a common phenomenon with many complex undertakings and projects. To get the first 80 or 90% of the project completed usually takes less overall effort and cost than completing the last 10 to 20%. And I would ask the question, if as a society we dedicated the same amount of money that it'll take to get us from an 80% or a 90% carbon-free generation portfolio and put that into efforts to reduce carbon in agriculture, transportation, and industrial sectors, we may have a lot more carbon reductions a lot quicker and at lower cost. So I do understand that a message is important. 100% by 2050 sounds more compelling than 90% by 2050, but looking at a holistic approach and finding a way to reduce carbon at the lowest possible cost we think is in the interest of all of our citizens. That said, SEMPA stands ready to be a partner in meeting the state's carbon reduction objectives in the most cost-effective manner possible. Thank you.
Thank you. David Schaefer and then Rob Scott Hovland. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Schaefer, Executive Director of the Minnesota Solar Energy Industries Association. We're incredibly supportive of House File 1956, and we hope the House Energy Committee rallies around the bill. The bill being considered today is a tremendous first step towards a clean energy economy. Putting aggressive goals for renewables not only helps mitigate climate change, but also supports one of the fastest growing business sectors in the country, solar. Solar installer is the fastest growing job in America, and a bill like this one would further bolster the industry here in the state. Currently, there are about 4,000 Minnesotans employed in the solar sector, and our solar industry is only about 2% of the state's energy mix. We estimate that a bill like this one before the committee could substantially increase the employment of solar installers in the state and could increase our jobs up to 40,000. This bill will truly result in a green Minnesota economy and promote jobs throughout the state. It will also help Minnesota produce more of its energy in-state instead of importing it from other places like Canada or across the globe. Focusing on a renewable future is a focus on a more distributed future, so the need to transport coal by train, gas by pipeline, or even electricity through power lines is lessened when we put solar panels closer to the areas they need to serve. Our energy future is safer with homegrown energy. MNCEA truly believes that Minnesota will benefit from this bill and 100% clean energy framework. We urge the committee members to consider this bill to the fullest extent and adopt it at a later time. Thank you for your consideration, and we hope that you like what we had to say. Thanks.
Representative Garofalo, do you have a question?
Yes, for the testifier, and thank you for your testimony. You focused on homegrown jobs. This bill, would it allow renewable energy that's produced in other states to qualify for the standard?
Madam Chair, Chairman Garofalo, most likely yes.
Madam Chair, I think the answer is yes, or I would defer to Mr. Eloff, but the answer to that is yes. Also, does this bill make any changes to the REC process where right now a utility could just say, hey, we're on paper, we're buying the solar energy down in another state, and we're getting credit for that. Does this bill make any changes to that process so that the money could just go out of state to meet our carbon standards?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, no, it does not.
It does, Madam Chair, and Mr. Schaefer, what does not?
The bill does not change the REC procurement method.
Okay, so Madam Chair and Mr. Schaefer, so that'd be more out-of-state jobs, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Chairman, or Representative Garofalo, I suppose if they decided to procure the RECs from out of state, then yes.
Okay. Well, so Madam Chair and the testifier, the three arguments that the author of this bill has brought forward is the number one, that it's going to create jobs in Minnesota; number two, that it's going to reduce pollution; and then number three, that it's going to save money. Those have been sort of the three propositions. So I'm just going to focus on this job creation side of things. You said something interesting about the amount of job growth, and I'm wondering if this is truly about, particularly with solar installers, I think we could make a lot more jobs, we could create a lot more jobs if we prohibited those installers from using power tools. If we required them to do everything by hand, you would need a lot more labor and a lot more job. You would need, that would employ more people, right? Wouldn't that accomplish that goal?
Representative Garofalo, correct, yes.
Okay, so Madam Chair, under the testifier, would that be a good public policy?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I do not believe that would be a good public policy.
Okay, and so, Madam Chair, under the testifier, why would that not be a good policy?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that would be sort of an excessive government overreach causing the level of worker pricing to increase too rapidly.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, the productivity wouldn't be worth it. When you look at the cost for amount of megawatt hour created, it would certainly require much more labor, but it's the same reason we don't have construction workers use spoons when they're moving dirt. That productivity and efficiency is part of it. So having a more labor-intensive energy production process is not necessarily indicative of a good public policy. What we want to do is we want to have the most amount of energy created at the lowest possible price and the lowest amount of pollution. We want to dial those 3 meters together. And so what I see from my history of job creation related to rooftop solar, it's an extremely expensive energy source. Its pollution mitigation is minimal because it's primarily replacing natural gas, which does emit more pollution than nuclear or hydro. But it's a pretty minimal amount of pollution mitigation. And then on the cost side, I don't think there's any dispute that rooftop solar is one of the most expensive ways to produce energy. So I've asked you a lot of questions. You've been a good sport, so you get the closing words on why it's a good bill again.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I appreciate that. I think that the analogy does fall short a little bit in the sense that while we are encouraging jobs in this bill, I don't believe that we're encouraging jobs that shouldn't be encouraged, I guess. These are jobs that are likely coming in one way or another. I believe they're going to be here in state. Now, whether or not this bill goes into effect or not doesn't dictate whether these happen. I think it's more about pacing. Solar is quickly becoming one of the cheapest forms of energy in the entire world. So all in all, what this bill does in our minds is it codifies that this state is committed to green energy and these jobs, and they want to see it sooner than later. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Spasinski, were you on the line?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to the testifier, just talking about kind of solar got me thinking a little bit. We talked, Xcel's Energy's got a 2% potential from solar. Does your organization kind of have a internal goal of what you'd like to see as far as total solar generation throughout the state or region?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, so there's a short and a long answer to that. I think the long-term vision for the solar industry, why not have it all solar, right? But I think that's unlikely the case. So our real vision right now, at least at this point in time, is currently there's a 10% solar energy goal. We'd like to see that effectively become a standard, so that's about 6 gigawatts and 10%, so 5 times what we have today.
Madam Chair, and just from, from a land use perspective, does your association, it's obviously in state law that we're not supposed to be taking, prime farmland out of production. Does your association have a particular policy goal and whether that should be, upheld, so that we're using, less desirable land, less productive land, rather than taking those things out of production?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski, I wouldn't say we have a goal yet on this because this is an issue that's come about because of the recent success of solar. When I started at Mincia, there maybe were 30 megawatts of solar, and that's 5 to 8 acres per megawatt about. So there wasn't that much. Now we're up to almost a gigawatt of solar. That's a huge growth, and with it has come some growing pains. So the ideas of where does this go to reduce that, that's a new conversation, but one we're certainly willing to have. Brownfields, rooftops, those are really good places to put these things. So we're just starting that conversation, but we're open to it.
Madam Chair, I would just encourage your association to really look at that as a real possibility. If your goal is 10%, of all power, in Minnesota, you're potential looking at 300,000 to 400,000 acres of land. You know, if you don't think that's going to make a big impact in rural Minnesota in food production, and our obviously solar is a different product, has a different cost, but I think it's going to make a big impact. Just, you know, from an association standpoint, what percentage of solar panels being installed in Minnesota are made in the U.S.?
Madam Chair, Representative Swazinski. So that number's changed a lot. Currently, I would say it's not that many, although we do have a manufacturing plant in state up in there in Range, and it's called Haleen. The tariffs actually have caused some manufacturing to be started in the United States, but probably, I guess I would be just speculating to hazard a guess, but I can get back to you on that.
Madam Chair, does anybody know what percentage of the solar panels are made in the United States? I would say it's very, very little.
That's probably
You know, I think just a deeper conversation is, you know, where those things come from, who are building them. You know, we want to, you know, promote policies when it comes to battery. That's all in this bill, to be able to capture that and turn it into battery. I mean, a lot of that stuff is, we talked about the labor. We talked about folks, and, you know, essentially this is going to be pushing, you know, slave labor in other countries to help build these things. And, you know, that's, you know, having policy like that, you know, we say we want to have our energy come from Minnesota. Well, in reality, where these places come from to build the batteries, to build the, to mine the cadmium and the nickel and all those other things, you know, that comes from places where they don't have near the standards that we do. And you know, I've said it before, if we don't, what should we do with our land and land use and production and agriculture? We push it to other countries. So they're going to chop down rainforests in Brazil. They're going to do other things as well. Those are the intended consequences. And as we push this policy, you know, from technology that doesn't exist, that we say, well, it will be there someday, what it will mean to the total global economy. It's not all roses and candy bars. So.
Representative Stevenson has the next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, I wanted to clarify something because I think the testifier and may have unintentionally mischaracterized it. Just a small piece of the bill is the questioning of Representative Garofalo related to the effect on local jobs in this bill. While it doesn't change the procedure around RECs, the bill does include, and I would direct members' attention to Section 4 of Article 2, which is on page 11, starting on line 11.26, it does add language to the carbon-free standard, indicating that the Commission needs to maximize local benefits to local workers throughout the state, including the creation of high-quality jobs in Minnesota that pay wages, that support families, recognition of the rights of the workers to organize and unionize. I would also note that Article 1, which is the Clean Energy First section of the Act, also contains a preference for local job creation. That subdivision, that's Section 10 of Article 1, which you can find on page 7, starting at 720. So I know that there wasn't any intent to mischaracterize the bill here anyway. I just wanted to correct that there is language in the bill, throughout the bill, that should add an incentive for more local job creation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Stevenson, I guess I'm kind of, are you disputing that the capacity factor for wind is higher in North Dakota than it is in most of Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I'm simply pointing out that there's local job creation language in multiple sections of the bill, and so the bill does do things to try and benefit local jobs. Well, are you disputing that?
Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, yeah, I am. I see some comfort language in there that was supposed to address people's concerns, but it doesn't do anything. It's like saying the Commission needs to take into effect the count of the affordability, but we've seen skyrocketing rates across the state for well over 10 years. But Madam Chair and Representative Stevenson, when we're building wind and solar projects, their close proximity to interconnects is a big factor, and capacity factors matter. So, for example, no matter what we do in Minnesota, with the exception of southwestern Minnesota, North Dakota is going to have better wind than us. They're just going to have a higher capacity factor than us. Likewise, no matter what we do with our solar development here, if you put solar panels up in Nevada, you're going to get a higher capacity factor. And so it seems to me that you are under the impression that this language would put the thumb on the scale to create jobs in Minnesota, which would make this even more expensive than we're saying it is. Now, if you can explain to me how identical windmills close to identical interconnects can have the same price, even though one has a higher capacity factor, I'm interested in the science that you're using. Can you just kind of run through that with us? Because it doesn't exist.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, I guess I would make 2 points. When you say except in southern Minnesota, you kind of have an exception that swallows the rule there. And the second thing is I take issue with what you're saying about this being comfort language. The language in Section 10 in the Clean Energy Standard says that the commission must report on associated local job impacts and must consider local job impacts and give preference to proposals that maximize creation of construction and employment opportunities for local workers. And I'm sure you're not meaning to imply the PUC is going to ignore those statutory frameworks.
No, Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, actually, I was hoping you were going to say exactly that. There's a federal court case that says what you just described is unconstitutional and illegal under the Commerce Clause. You have just on the record made an argument that the state of Minnesota made as an argument in the North Dakota coal case where on summary judgment we lost that case. The argument you just made was the argument they made in that case. You have just put into the record why this law is a violation of the U.S. Constitution. Representative, I want to thank you for your contribution to today's discussion.
I think we went beyond there. Representative Long.
Madam Chair, just to address the point, this does not address the North Dakota, Minnesota issue. This is giving requiring the commission to take all reasonable actions. That is not requiring the state to not purchase energy from one state or another. And so I think this does not violate the principles of the
law. Hold on, Madam Chair, Representative Long, that's not what Representative Stevenson just said. He just said must. Madam Chair, he said must. Did I misunderstand? We could maybe have the tape played back.
You can review the language if you prefer, but that's not what the language says. The language is clear that this is a requirement that the PUC take into consideration, and to Representative Stevenson's point, I do believe that the PUC takes what the legislature puts in law very seriously and will address the local preferences.
Madam Chair, my final point is it can't be one or the other. It can't be both. Okay? Either we're forcing people to do it, in which case it's unconstitutional, or it's comfort language. So if you, as the author, if you want to take exception with what Representative Stevenson has said, by all means, go ahead, but we're just trying to figure out which side of the coin you're on in this one. Candidly, either way, I win the argument, so I'm happy to have you answer it either way.
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, thankfully there's a door number three, and the bill does allow for a preference for local jobs that does not fall into either of the two buckets you've stated, and that's going to be a good thing, I think, for Minnesota workers. As you pointed out on the previous bill hearing, there is the ability to have some flexibility to purchase renewable energy out of state, but there's a lot of reasons to purchase renewable energy in state aside from capacity factors and like having load close to where you're going to be delivering it and reducing the cost of delivery of energy. So there are a lot of reasons why you're going to want to produce energy in Minnesota aside from those that you've stated.
Thank you. Next we have Rob Scott Hovland and then Kristen Lim.
Good evening. Good afternoon. My name is Rob Scott Hovland with Missouri River Energy Services. Chair Wagenius and members of the committee, I want to thank you for allowing me to testify on 1956. In regards to the questions that were asked this morning, I don't believe, to the best of my knowledge, we were ever contacted by the governor's office. In regards to the second half of that question, Missouri River, and we've been working with the advocates for clean energy and for energy efficiency programs and renewable programs pretty much consistently to try to find the best pathway forward for all of our customers. In a clean energy future is a priority for all of us. As a joint action agency, we will continue to develop new renewable resources and seek new pathways to bring those resources to our customers. I'd first like to highlight a couple of portions of the bill that will help Missouri River move forward towards a clean energy future. For example, the recognition that hydroelectric facilities, particularly pumped hydro, will need to play an expanded role in the development of clean energy. Pumped hydro storage would allow for longer run times, greater reliability, and better support for intermittent renewable energy. We also support the inclusion of energy efficiency and load management programs in the definition of a clean energy resource. For Missouri River, energy efficiency has been one of our least cost resources, and we will continue to develop and offer conservation programs for all of our companies. We also want to recognize the challenges posed by this bill. The scope of the Governor's Clean Energy Act will require resources beyond Minnesota's borders, with new transmission pathways extending outside of the state. Transmission constraints will become a problem, especially for utilities like Missouri River Energy, which are we are dependent on other transmission providers to provide those pathways and connect resources to our Minnesota members and their customer owners. Additionally, transmission is expensive. A recent Brattle Group study estimates that $30 to $90 billion of incremental transmission will be required by 2030 to meet the needs of electrification. Finally, we support the use of renewable energy as demonstrated by our Red Rock Hydroelectric Project. However, it must be done with a measured approach to minimize the impact on customers. Thank you again, and we look forward to continue working on these projects.
Thank you. Kristen Lynn and then Lauren Schoenhorst, and I believe that's going to be the last testifier. She's going to, unless, and while you're coming up, I just wanted to note for the record that it's my understanding that Minnesota Power, there was a misstatement before, Minnesota Power did work on the underlying language of this bill and had seen the actual language several days before it was introduced. With that, Kristen Lynn, welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Lynn, and I'm here today with Take Action Minnesota. We're a grassroots organization representing 55,000 Minnesotans in every county of the state, as well as 22 organizational members. I'm here to support the governor's pathway to 100% bill because I'm tired of waiting for tomorrow's solutions to save us. I work for a public radio program that often asks its guests, what in this moment makes you despair and what gives you hope? As we experience more extreme weather events and the effects of climate change, I sympathize with anyone who feels despair about the decades of procrastination that have brought us to this moment when we're asking ourselves, what were we doing 20 years ago? I often feel this despair. I feel it because I first heard about climate change when I was in elementary school. Climate change on the back burner again and again, as I've grown from child to teenager to college student and now working professional. I especially despair when I think about how our political apathy disproportionately affects and fails already vulnerable communities, like our state's farmers, communities of colors, and those struggling from health problems. But if climate change makes me despair, seeing bills like this gives me hope. I'm hopeful today because the only step left for us to transition 100% renewable energy is to cultivate enough political will to make this happen. I'm hopeful today because the pathway to 100% will allow us to build a Minnesota that is sustainable for the future, for future generations. And I sincerely hope that we don't look back to this moment in the future with regret. I applaud the lawmakers in this room who recognize that they're in a position to ensure that we don't. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Lauren Schoenhorst, and as far as I know, that's the last testifier. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lauren Schoenhorst, and I serve as the Energy Policy Director for the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, representing 2,300 employers of every size and over 500,000 employees in every industry across the state. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to share with this committee the position of our members regarding the state's approach to energy policy. So I'll be brief with my regard to my comments in opposition to House File 1956, the Governor's Clean Energy First Act. Maintaining reliable, cost-effective power at competitive prices is the Minnesota Chamber's energy policy priority. According to the U.S. Energy Information Association, Minnesota's commercial and industrial electric rates have increased faster than U.S. inflation and average. This is an alarming trend for our members. The cost of energy in our state influences operations and future investment in Minnesota. That is why, to power our state, our members support strategies that consider all of the energy resources available, and yes, our members consider efficiencies, and emerging technological, operational, and optimization opportunities to be part of that mix, as long as those strategies result in cost-effective power, competitive rates, ensure energy system reliability, and do not shift costs to others. Given current market dynamics and increasingly competitive costs for renewable energy, the state can achieve its energy policy goals without imposing additional mandates. We also agree that energy efficiency programs can reduce the need for utilities to build additional generation and support potential updates to the state's program to allow for additional energy efficiency opportunities to the extent it remains cost-effective for CNI ratepayers and benefits Minnesota's energy customers. Finally, the Chamber believes that preserving the financial health of both our utilities and energy industries benefits all Minnesotans. However, our members already believe that the state's current regulatory process governed by the Minnesota PUC and the Department of Commerce are not clear, timely, predictable, and accountable. We are concerned that proposals such as this will exacerbate these issues for our businesses as ratepayers, as utilities, and as energy industries. In closing, maintenance, enhancements, and modernization efforts to our systems and programs must result in competitive prices. Creating mandates regardless of the cost or efficiency does not serve our members' energy policy goals. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to share this perspective with your committee today. As I stated in the beginning, as stakeholders, our members have significant concerns and questions about the proposal and do not support its passage at this time.
Representative Straczynski, did you have a question?
Oh, Madam Chair, I just wanted to make sure I was on the list after the last testifier. So if there's another testifier that may come out of the public, we can take that up.
Okay, She was the last testifier that signed up, and some who signed up and took their name off the list. So we've had a long sign-up. But if there is somebody else in the audience who would like to testify, they're welcome to do it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lauren Lontag from Watertail Power in Fergus Falls. I believe I got a yes from Mr. Molzon when I asked to testify. So as a reminder, half of Watertail's customers are in Minnesota and half are in the Dakotas. With respect to Article 1, to answer questions by Representative Swiedzinski, Representative Stevenson, yes, we have been a stakeholder since December of 2018. We've been working on this article. And actually, I had a conversation last week in Representative Stevenson's office and thought we had a very good conversation. The bill tightens up the requirements of 216B.2422. And so just to let you know how this works out in the real world, when my company filed our last IRP, or Integrated Resource Plan, we proposed, keep in mind that in the modern era, you can only do wind, gas, and solar. You can't do coal or nuclear anymore. So we proposed replacing our Hoot Lake coal plant in Fergus Falls. It's got capacity and energy. I want everyone to understand those terms. You buy, when you source power, you source energy and you source capacity. Hoot Lake plant or a coal plant or a nuclear plant or a natural gas facility offer both capacity and energy. And in our integrated resource plan, we proposed to replace it with a wind project in North Dakota, 150-megawatt Maricourt wind project. And that's for energy. Someone said this morning that wind is the cheapest energy. That's true. But remember, wind is not capacity. You get 14% capacity credit for wind. And for capacity, we are replacing Hoot Lake coal plant in Fergus Falls with Astoria gas plant in South Dakota, which happens to fall at the intersection of a 345,000-volt transmission line co-owned by Ottertail Power and Xcel Energy and a high-pressure transmission gas line coming from Canada. With respect to Article 2, when did we find out about Article 2? I got a call from Deputy Commissioner Sullivan on the Friday before the governor had his news conference, and so that was the first news that there would be a carbon-free energy standard, which in my mind becomes the clean energy-only standard in 2050. Finally, I'll just talk about Article 3 for a second. The Energy Optimization Act, we have been stakeholders in that since the fall of 2018. And we look forward to working with Representative Long and others on the continued development of Article 3, the Energy Optimization Act. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Did you have a question?
Yes.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Lochtog. Does Otter Tail Power currently have a solar mandate in law?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Garofalo, we do, and it is in effect as of 2020, yes.
And Madam Chair, and to the testifier, right now, based on the public information, my understanding is that Otter Tail Power is going to meet that solar mandate primarily by purchasing RECs from out of state. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Garofalo, that is correct. We always check the price of solar. The price of solar continues to come down. It has not quite reached the point of being able to do solar in our service territory compared to buying RECs on the MRECs market.
And Madam Chair, into the testifier, my final question. Short of taking the Earth's axis and twisting it so that Minnesota is farther south, do you see any way that the capacity factor of Minnesota could be equal or better than those of our southern states?
Madam Chair and Representative Garofalo, likely not. I'm not an expert in that, but likely not.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Long, I don't see discussion here unless Representative Spasinski.
Yes, Madam Chair. I just had a general question, too. I think there's folks from the PUC here. Is there anyone here from the PUC? Oh, there we go. And would they be willing to kind of come up? I just have a couple questions kind of talking about off-ramps and some reliability questions. Would they be at all interested? If they're not interested, we can.
Okay, we're getting really close to time because we have another committee coming in this room. We can ask them if they would be available when we roll out the bill. Would that be okay?
That'd be all right, Madam Chair. And then just would like to, you know, we heard some testimony on some of the technologies that potentially are out there with, you know, carbon sequestration. It's been a long day. And, you know, I would like to move the A11 amendment, if that'd be possible at all. I know we spoke a little bit about that earlier, but I do feel it's important after hearing testimony that potentially we would move those.
So here's the problem. When you withdrew the amendments, I did not have staff put them back in the folders this afternoon because they were withdrawn. So we will make sure that that is at the top of the list when this comes back. I will commit to that.
But Madam Chair, I would like to, I do feel it's important to listen to the folks that do comment on our bills and, because sometimes their testimony may be related to something that could potentially change. You know, I believe that, you know, as a conversation, we're as legislators to listen and hear, and testimony can change whether or not an amendment would be heard or not. And, I would argue the fact that I think we should hear testimonies always before we, and you're obviously the chair, this is your committee, appreciate you're doing it, hearing those things after and allowing the amendments to be heard after the testimony, I think is an important step in good legislating. So,
thank you. Is there any other comments? Representative Baker, did you have a comment before we wrap up?
I guess I did, Madam Chair. I was also looking forward to talking about these amendments that were really important to me. I didn't withdraw my amendments on the table. And I guess I really wanted to hear the testimony from so many people, both in favor of it and against it, because this is really an important bill, and I want to make sure we get this right. And I think, again, as I've learned in the short time that I've been here, you know, walking through bills in committee is what we do to really make it better. And I really thought I had some good ideas to bring forward, and I don't want my voice not heard. So I'm hoping that maybe we could either table this bill and set it aside and bring it back where we can really talk about a lot of these amendments, because I don't know when I'll have another opportunity to do that, when it's fresh in my mind and when I've just heard this testimony. But, I mean, just things like the SIP improvement stuff that I've been working on the last few years, my co-author, or actually the lead author, Representative Rob Eklund, has a really good SIP bill that I'm a co-author on that I think is much better for our munis and our co-ops and folks that are better than what Representative Long brought together, and he slammed this in this bill, which I don't think is the right place for this.
So I want to talk about Representative Eklund's bill that I think is a good bill. There's some just really other concerns. So, Madam Chair, I guess this is important for us to really dive in. This is not a small bill. This is a omnibus rethink the world as we know it in Minnesota bill. And I respect what we want to do. I also want to get to a carbon-free world, but I also want to do it without doubling or tripling the potential rates that we might pay and hurt the folks that we could hurt the worst, our most vulnerable citizens, without that intention, but I think we need to get this right. So, Madam Chair, I'm hoping that we could either table this and we bring it back at a later time, or I was expecting to be here till midnight tonight if that was what it was going to take. I didn't know that there was going to be another hearing tonight, and I, you know, whatever time it is, but I'd like to keep going if we could, but I'm just, again, sharing my wishes that I want to make sure these amendments get talked about at some point.
They will be here's the situation we're in. The amendments were offered by Representative Swiecinski. He withdrew them all. I did not have them put back in people's folders since they were withdrawn. We will, when we come back and do our omnibus bill, we will have a week to look at that bill. So we plan to roll it out on a Monday, and we will talk about it on a, we'll roll it out on a Monday, we'll talk about it on a Tuesday. You will have time to do amendments, and we'll have ample time. We have planned ample time for the discussions that we need to have. We're not going to do it fast.
Well, and I understand that, Madam Chair, but there's a lot of testifiers that may not be here that time. Like, I've got a number of questions for folks that maybe are opposed to the bill that I want to ask them about what the rates might look like or what their thoughts are on X, Y, and Z. But they may not be here, and I won't have the ability to do that when this comes around again. And I just want to be on the record that this is, I think we always have to make sure that amendments do end up, like Representative Swiecinski said, at the end of this conversation so that we can all have the most information in front of us when we talk about this. So this is an important bill that is far from ready. We heard the people in the state of Minnesota that do this every day for a living. Xcel Energy, they sell more than half of the energy in the state of Minnesota, does not like this bill. I don't know how much they were really talked about with this bill ahead of time. You know, on a thing that I've learned around here is when you bring a bill forward and you know a lot of folks are going to not like your bill, you make sure you talk to them. I don't think that happened here. My opioid bill that a lot of you know that I'm working on, I brought in all the folks that hated on that bill ahead of time to make sure we try to talk about these things so that we try to make it as best we could with knowing what their, some of those objections might be. And because of that, we have a better bill today because of that. I don't think that happened here. We have a freshman legislator carrying a very big bill that requires some intense collaborations with all partners on this, and I don't think that happened here. So we need to now in committee make sure that we understand it and digest this and talk about it and bring all these people forward so we can have our day with this bill in front of the cameras and the microphones, because a lot of folks in Minnesota are looking at this. This is an important bill. So I just urge the chair to either go longer tonight or we make sure that we get most of these folks in, because this is really important, and I need to make sure that I stand up and fight for what I believe is a good balance of reliable, affordable energy. And again, I think we're missing that part of it. I also think renewables are a huge part of our future, but Madam Chair, I just urge that we go further and longer, and we make sure this gets back as soon as possible. Thank you.
We have had almost 40 folks testifying, and I recognized every person who wanted to ask a testifier a question. With that, Representative Long.
Madam Chair, and, you know, I do believe, I was just listening to Representative Baker, and I do not believe that this bill is ready for prime time, and I think that I would like to make a motion to table this bill, and I'd like a roll call.
The motion is not debatable. The clerk will take the roll. And the motion is to table, and the chair votes no.
Representative Swiecinski?
Aye.
Representative McComb?
No.
Representative Baker?
Yep.
Representative Bierman?
No.
Representative Bowe? Representative Christensen?
No.
Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Representative Halverson?
No.
Representative Hornstein?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mahoney? Representative Meckland?
Aye.
Representative Stevenson?
No.
There being four ayes and seven nays, the motion to table does not prevail. Representative Long, do you renew your motion that House File 1956 be laid over for possible inclusion?
I do, Madam Chair, and if I could just make a couple of quick closing remarks. I know we have a committee coming in, so I'll be brief. I just want to thank the many witnesses who came out today to testify on the bill, and there are many points in the legislative process when folks can weigh in on legislation, and I'm grateful that we had over 2 hours of testimony today when folks could weigh in on the bill and try to help it make it better. I also want to thank our colleagues for expressing support for the goal that we're trying to get to here, Representative Garofalo. So this was a goal we all share to make move our state towards a carbon-free world. Representative Baker shared that goal, said that he also would like to see us move to a carbon-free world. I think the goal of this bill for me is trying to filter the goal that we share through the lens of science. And science has said that we need to be net zero by 2050. That is the date that the governor has set in this bill. That is a date that others are moving forward on. There are three states in the United States that have committed to this and are moving forward on it. We also learned this week that the state of Saudi Arabia has said that they want to be free of oil by 2050. So if Saudi Arabia can do it, I think Minnesota can do it too. There's been a lot of testimony about affordability and reliability, and I have good news for those who testified with concerns about that. All three provisions of the bill have exceptions for affordability and reliability, such that if the PUC finds that any of the three sections are not going to be affordable or not going to be reliable, there are off-ramps for each of those. So your concerns are met, and you can rest easy. The bill sets a target that is 31 years away. That is a generation and a half. There was a testimony that that is two contract cycles in utility talk, which I think highlights the urgency of doing it right now. Because if we don't set a long-term target right now, we're going to be missing some of the planning that is happening right now that has 15, 20-year impacts on the greenhouse gas emissions that we are going to be locking in. This bill sets a very achievable goal, and it has two very flexible approaches for how we get there that are proven, using efficiency and using our existing integrated resource planning process through the Public Utilities Commission. I want to thank Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for their proposal. I'm honored to carry it, and I'm grateful for the testimony today. Thank you, Madam Chair.
House File 1956 is laid over. There is no further business, and this meeting is adjourned.